session held earlier tonight upon a motion made by Board Member Jim Quesenberry, seconded by Board Member Chris Unger. The board took action to suspend without pay for a period of 3 days employee number 8573 for repeated violation of the Merit System Rule 10.1. Our next item is during closed session held earlier tonight upon a motion made by Board Member Walter Millar, seconded by Board Member Jim Quesenberry. The board adopted a resolution pursuant to Education Code Section 44951 that authorized the district superintendent or his designee to notify administrative employee number 38852 of reassignment from an administrative position to a teaching position effective at the end of the 2014-15 school year by a roll call vote, and the vote was 6 ayes, 0 noes, 0 abstentions, and 1 absence. That concludes the reporting out of closed session items, and we will move forward to open session. The first is consensus on the order of business. Do we have consensus?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes, sir.
All right. Next, approval of minutes of February 13th, 2015. Any comments, corrections, revisions? If not, I would entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
I'll move approval.
I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Oh, you're... Okay. We have 6 approvals and 1 absence. Dr. Prater, did you... No. Okay. Next is the approval of the minutes of the February 17th, 2015 meeting. Any additions, changes, revisions?
Mr. Millar, do you have yourself sorted out over there?
I'm close.
Okay.
I kept getting this weird version.
You need a motion. You need
I do.
I wasn't at that meeting, so I don't think I can move approval.
Okay, you're right. You can't. Marilyn,
I'll move approval of the minutes of the meeting of February 17th.
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Do we have any all in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Aye.
And Mr. Quesenberry abstains because he was not present at that meeting, and Ms. Eisendrath Rogers is not here, so as an absence in that vote. All right. Moving right along, approval of the minutes of February 24th, 2015. Any changes, revisions, anything?
I'll move approval of the minutes of...
Move approval of the minutes of the meeting on February 24th, 2015.
I'll second it.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay. Mr. Millar was not. Is that the meeting you did not attend?
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Millar abstains. Ms. Eisendrath Rogers is not present. Everyone else says yes. All right. Jono. Save me from this for a few minutes here.
All right. Well, hi, everybody. I didn't think I'd get a hello back, but I guess I got it from a different room. So I'd like to open up talking about how spring... Are we good?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I can definitely hear the difference.
Phone your friend.
Hello.
Yeah, very good.
Thank you. I'll expect compliments from the rest of you later, in note form.
50s and hundreds.
So spring sports are now beginning to start up. Considering that this trimester is coming to a close, our boys soccer went on to second round CIF this trimester, and they lost in double overtime
wow.
to PKs. So that was a pretty big source of discussion for a while there. But they're back on their feet. A bunch of them are going out for track or swimming, and they're back and ready to play again. We have our Mock Rock talent show coming up on the 19th. That is what we're trying to build up, I guess I should say rebuild, in the sense that it was big at San Luis Obispo High School, and then it fell into a lull there where it wasn't that big of a deal, and now we're trying to amp it up as it used to be. So that'll be two different categories, one of people who are displaying their talents, and then another category of people who are lip-syncing two songs. So people can win in both areas. We have our student-staff basketball game on the 13th, which is a legendary event where we have the varsity basketball players playing against a staff team. And Mr. Simon, legend has it, he received his skills from a freak accident involving Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant in a laboratory. That's what most of the freshmen believe. And I ensure you that I will make sure that that myth stays alive. Student Congress comes up on the...
Don't let him slam dunk. Oh, sorry.
Oh, I'd want to see it. I'd pay money to see that. But you don't have to because it's free. Thought I'd plug that right there. We have our Student Congress meeting coming up on the 25th. It'll be the first one of this trimester, so we'll have completely new students from new home-based classes. We like to bring that because we bring in our administration and the ASB, and we talk about what we're doing, and we listen to some feedback on what students have to say. And this last week was FFA week, in which the FFA classes displayed everything that they've been doing over the year and past years, and really promoted a great sense of community within their organization, and it shed a lot of light onto something I was not that aware about, but they do a lot of great stuff, and it was a really good week. And we've got our spring dance coming up at the end of this month. It's going to be a blast and a half. Further details will be on that. And this week is finals, so with that, I'm going to ask All right. if I can go study economics for 12 hours. I will. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. So, keeping with our happy agenda here, we next have the Teach Foundation Grant Awards. Terry Main.
Happy agenda, that's a good one. So I'm happy to be here and happy to share with you.
We're happy to have
some
you.
Some very happy grants or happy teachers behind me. This particular cycle, we were very pleased to be able to offer 17 teachers grants in the amount of $11,604. And a number of them have been so gracious to spend part of their evening with us and tell you about their grants. So without further ado, we're going to ask Amanda Lake to lead off and tell you about her sixth grade bucket percussion grant.
Hi. Some of you might know me by reputation, if not by face. I'm Amanda Lake. I teach music at the elementary school level at Pacheco, Bishop's Peak, Teach, and Los Ranchos elementary schools. Traditionally, fourth graders do recorders following the winter break. Fifth graders do guitar, and I've sort of been searching for something to do with my sixth graders. So following in the instrumental vein, I decided that we should do some bucket percussion. Very affordable. Get some sticks. They can make a lot of noise. I'll go home with a migraine. It'll be awesome. So maybe someday you guys will be lucky enough to have them come into the board meeting and you may thank me or curse me as you will. Yeah, I don't have too much more to say about that. I'm really excited. I got enough buckets for four schools. So awesome. Thanks, guys.
Um, My name is Michelle Hedrick, and I'm the library tech at Los Ranchos Elementary School. I would like to thank the Teach Foundation for giving us a grant to have author Greg Trine come and visit us in April, and I'm very excited to have him come. Our students are working really hard on their writing. Some may go on to become published authors, and meeting an author and making that connection, being able to laugh with them and hear about their struggles and their perseverance, it creates a great connection for our students. Some of these authors have stories about their childhoods, and maybe they were not even readers. Some of them struggled in school, so it's great to make that connection of these ideas and what you're going through right now is going to turn into something bigger. Anyway, I'd like to say thank you, and maybe you can even come. So it'll be April 30th if you'd like to. You're invited. Okay, thank you.
We have a graphic. Hi, I'm Katie Peters, fourth grade at Sinsheimer, and Gail Becker is my teaching partner. And we are here to say thank you because, as you know, fourth grade studies California missions. And so all of our students got a grant to make these beautiful mission tiles that they take home and we put out at Open House. And Gail will tell you a little bit more about them.
It's kind of cool because that one and Katie's and Michelle's daughter's, this is a son of mine, those are all my past students, and we've done these throughout the years. So the money goes towards our resident artist, Bonnie Johnson, comes and teaches perspective drawing, which also includes a lot of math because of the looking at rulers and parallel lines and perpendicular and trapezoids. And then it goes towards the purchase of the tiles and also for the glaze. So it's a fun project, and all 60 of our fourth graders get to participate. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Alan, can I go? You go first.
So does this take the place of the sugar cube missions?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And do you want to know why?
Because
there's
we don't
story
want sugar in the
street.
Because of ants. I don't know.
Because my husband, who is also a teacher here in this district, he's going to love that I'm telling you this story. But you know how the fourth grade projects don't become a student project oftentimes. And I'm just going to say that Chris was really proud of how well he did on his mission tile with his fourth grade daughter.
Thank you.
So we're letting the kids do it now.
So my question was the same as Chris's, but I wondered whether the glaze was really sugar and if I could have a tile. So thank you.
Good evening, board. I'm Vicki Worley. I'm currently a sixth grade teacher at Teach Elementary School and having a really great time. I wrote a grant this year, and I thank the Teach Foundation. I actually was a recipient of the very first Teach grants back in 19-something. It was when we combined Del Mar and Morrow Elementary together. And I wrote a grant for that thing, and I don't know if you remember, I came in wearing half of a red and half of a blue sweatshirt because we melded them together. Anyway, so it's great to be a recipient again. Now I'm at a very interesting school with some really interesting kids, and this is really an interesting project. We have applied for some 3D printer pens. And this, we've been working with Cal Poly a lot lately in their Learn by Doing program and learning a lot about applying science and technology and engineering and arts and mathematics all together. And what we're going to do with this project is Mr. Lanier, Rex Lanier, my teaching partner, and I will each get one of these kits from the 3D Doodle Pen Company. We'll have 12 printer pens in our room. We're going to teach the children how to use them safely. They're very similar to glue guns, you could say, but you're going to they'll first learn how to work in a two-dimensional perspective, and as each piece dries and they peel it up, then they can assemble things such as bridges and the Eiffel Tower, as you see in the pictures there. There are a lot of things you can do with them. It takes a lot of skill and to be able to do them in the air, but if you catch any of those videos on YouTube of these new 3D printer pens, they are really something else. Dr. John Chen from Cal Poly has been working with my class. He came in and met with my class and told them that within 10 years, every household will have a 3D printer, just like every household has a television set or a PS3 or whatever it is you all have out there. But the idea is that if for no other reason than to make household items that break around the house that you just need to repair. Instead of, I know, not a good time to invest in hardware stores, right, Mrs. Rogers? I think I'm going to invest in plastic is what I'm going to do. So we're looking at a lot of good ways. So one of the culminating projects with this particular 3D printer pen project is for the children to actually create an object that can be used around the house that has a practical purpose and usefulness, even if it's something to just repair something around the house, fix that one little hinge on the door or whatever. Eventually, they'll be using it for all kinds of points in architecture and engineering, learning all different perspectives in math and art. It's a very, very challenging project. We're really looking forward to that. Any questions? All right, thank you.
Hello, my name is CJ Davis. I am the most intensive special day class teacher at Laguna Middle School. And I am so excited about this grant because we get to, my students and I and my para educators get to continue to go to Cal Poly every Friday. And we work with the kinesiology department, the students there. And they work with our students one-on-one and in small groups, getting them ready for Special Olympics. And the Special Olympics takes place May 1st at Cuesta. And this grant also pays for us to all have matching T-shirts and prepares us to go to Special Olympics. So if you would like to come see some wonderful, wonderful students in their events, it is May 1st at Cuesta College. So thank you, and thank you, Teach Grant. It's all day.
Good evening, Board. My name is Hillary Spindler, and I'm a sixth grade teacher at LOMS in the STEAM program, where I teach English and Social Studies and STEAM. So with this program, we are really thrilled to go ahead and expand it throughout our entire school site. So I'm doing the second year in the sixth grade, and as you guys know, it's growing into being a full school site program next year. That's actually for Lindley, sorry. At any rate, so we are going to go ahead and expand STEAM, where videography is going up into eighth grade, and sixth grade is where they get their first taste of this. And Eric Jarvis and I have gone ahead and have infused a program where we use Audacity to create radio ads, and we go ahead and use flip cameras, where students are able to go ahead and video themselves, working in collaborative groups, communicating, and cooperatively using their creative critical thinking skills to expand what it is that they are learning about in our English classes. So with this basic foundation that they'll have in sixth grade, they'll be able to move up into seventh grade and into eighth grade with it. Any questions? Rattle, 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 right? All right, with that, Lindley.
Good evening, Board. Thanks for having us. And Teach Foundation, Terry, thank you very much for all the hard work you do and for the grant. And as Vicki Worley said, I was also in the first round of Teach and used to take my students to the telethon. So back in the day, yes, I'm covering that hair gray, yes. Okay, so this year I also got a Teach grant for my Los Osos Starting a Drama Club. So with the STEAM program, we are honoring the A art. And we just completed our first full-scale production. This is actually the second one of the year, but we just got done doing American Revolution last weekend. We have 30 students in our drama club, and we will have open auditions next Tuesday for the spring production, which will be Alice in Wonderland, a musical. So as President Sheffer can tell you, she's got some alumni from that play and her family, so it's quite fun. And we have great musical talent, so we're using the choir and the band to incorporate us into the musicals. So we're just super excited about keeping the A going in STEAM at our school. Thank you very much.
Good evening, Board. My name is Leah Height, and I teach at Morbay High School. I teach biology. So in the past, Moore Bay High School has actually never, since the 80s, been able to take students on boats. So I was able to get this grant to take my students to the Avila Bay Aquarium and to take them on this floating lab. And what it entails is trolling for different types of fish and identifying different types of fish in the bay, as well as echinoderms and crustaceans and things like that. And so kids are going to have hands-on access to pulling things out of the bay. And then, so half the students, I'll take 70 with me. So half will be on the boat, and half will be in the aquarium dissecting rockfish and feeding octopus and things like that. So I'm very excited about it, and thank you so much.
Good evening, Board. My name is Ann Wilder. I am the Math Yearbook Sustainable Ag, sometimes PE teacher out as, and yes, submersible teacher out at Pacific Beach Continuation High School. We received a TEACH grant this year for yearbook class. It's going to allow the kids the opportunity to design their own yearbook, which allows them, one, to be able to obtain and afford the yearbook, and which a lot of them haven't been able to do in many years past. But it also teaches them many skills that they'll be able to carry on with them throughout the rest of their lives, and also put cell phones to good use for a change, where they can take pictures, learn how to upload, insert text, and make it a part of an appropriate project instead of a distractive one. Plus they get to collaborate, work with students that they might not normally work with, see finished work on page, on print, and come to the end and have something to be really proud of. So without the TEACH Foundation, we wouldn't have been able to make it so cost effective and provide it for everybody. So thank you so much.
Good evening, Board. My name is Cherie Jones. I'm from SLO High. I am an art teacher, and I would like to thank the TEACH organization for helping us continue the tradition of the Memory Project. This is the fourth or fifth year we have received the grant. The Memory Project is an organization that fundraises to help disadvantaged, neglected, and orphaned children from around the world. And what they do is they bring smiles to children through the medium of art. What you do is you tell them how many children you would like to create an artwork for, and what they do is they take their portrait and they send it to you. So with this grant, I'm able to provide portraits for a full class, and we're going to create their portrait in whatever medium, pastel, pencil, pen and ink, and we will send them back through the organization. They give them to the children, make happy smiles, and they photograph the children with the portrait, and they send us the copies back. And so the students, my students, and this is the first year I'm doing this. Deborah Sands has been doing it for several years. And what I understand is the students are going to it just brings so much joy to bring happiness to students who are children around the world who are disadvantaged through their own personal art, and they actually get to see the smiles themselves. So thank you very much.
Okay, I think that gave you a pretty good overview of what's happening at some of our schools. Are there any questions?
Any questions?
Fundraiser.
Eventually.
Okay.
You want to say?
You do? Okay, well, if I can get a lineup going right here, right now, just email me, and I'll let you know when it's scheduled. So thanks for having us, and thank you very much to all the teachers for all the great things you do.
Roger.
Carrie, I just wanted to say that every time we go through these grant cycles, because the podium faces us and the teachers are looking at us, they say thank you to us. But of course we know, and we want to make sure that you know that they are thanking you, and that the TEACH Foundation makes all of these grants possible. We're very appreciative.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we know how much they appreciate this. We really get a lot of good feedback directly from them. So I appreciate your saying so, Marilyn. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, teachers, for coming to share your exciting projects with us. It's so fun to hear about. Thank you so much. Okay. Item 6.01 is correspondence. I would state that I know that several of us have received correspondence since the last meeting having to do with a personnel issue. I can't get my iPad to bring up the meeting, so I can't look at... Okay. All right. Thank you. Now, Brian's coming to save me, as he does.
I'll put this here just in case.
Oh, I can share Marilyn's.
No, just use mine.
Okay, this is what I get.
Yeah.
Okay. And now's the time we open the podium up to public comment for anyone who would like to speak to an issue not on the agenda or doesn't want to wait for the agenda item to come up. Do we have anyone who would like to address the board at this time? Okay, how'd you do that? Okay, thank you.
It's a miracle.
It's a miracle.
I just refreshed it. Sometimes okay. The website does that, unfortunately. It gives you that
thank you.
Background.
Okay, now I have many computers. Thank you. Uh-huh. Superintendent's updates, business and budget.
So yeah, just a couple of things. Julie has a second interim tonight to review, so I'm going to hold off on most of the business items for that part of it. One just quick thing is regarding MA funding, and so I'll update you with in Friday notes. But there's been a lot of hem-ha about what to do and are we going to get reimbursed through MA funds, and it's still kind of that way. It's still kind of up in the air. It's really, to be honest with you, not good in that the federal government is looking at and the state, almost cutting that what they owe us in back payments really in half is kind of a settlement type of measure, and looking at a whole different type of measure in terms of doing MA and medical billing in the future. It's one of the things that you'll notice as we go through the 7-year budget that we've taken out of future years because it's something that we can't really count on.
What are we owed?
$9 million.
No. That's mandates. Not mandate costs. So this is MA funds.
I would say at least $600,000.
Yeah.
It's so over Julie said about over half a million, $600,000.
Will we continue to bill for it?
Oh yeah, we're still continuing to do all the things we're supposed to do through the process. So there's a brand new process that they have begun this year where they, instead of turning in our kind of reimbursables like we did in the past, now it's kind of a time survey where certain individuals, they'll email and they have to say what they did during that time. So it's a whole different method that they're trying. But it's just something that is kind of like the whole mandated costs, how now they're doing the block grant. At a much, less expensive way or in terms of the state repayment. So it's just something that we're going to have to see how it goes. But it's definitely something in terms of future years us counting on those funds. It doesn't look good. So just an update about that. And, again, Julie has a lot of information about second interim and budgeting, so we can address any other questions at that time. And then lastly, I'll just say with that, too, I should also mention there's a lot of bills right now being written, going through state legislature. There was one today. We just got a school services update that there's a law going through to repeal the reserve cap. And so we'll see how that goes in the future. So there's going to be a lot of legislation, and we'll keep the board updated as those things change.
Okay, thank you. Educational services update.
Yeah, Mrs. Holmes, can you pull up that graphic I had? It's actually a little PowerPoint. I just wanted to, I'll probably give some updates to the board over the next two or three meetings about spring assessments, about the new California assessment program, because that's going to be in everyone's minds as we work into the spring. So with the adoption of the Common Core state standards, California eliminated most of what were called the CSTs, the California Standards Tests. We still have one sitting out there. And so we the acronym we used for that was STAR. You remember STAR testing, which stood for Standardized Testing and Reporting Program. And we love to have acronyms in education. And so STAR is no longer with us. We have a new acronym, and that is CAASPP, CASP. The California Assessment of Student Performance and Progress. So this is the new STAR, and this was enacted in January of 2014. For us, what it really means is a new battery of tests. And the one that is getting the most attention is that is being developed by a consortium called the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, SBAC. So you sometimes hear the term SBAC now. Students are going to be going through SBAC testing. SBAC testing is the summative portion of it, and if you look at this triangle up here, the top part, the little box on the top, the summative part of it is intended for students in grades 3 through 8 and 11. So 7 grade levels will be tested, 3rd through 8th grade and grade 11, and these are in two areas, English language arts and mathematics. Most students will get tested. There will be some special education students that will not be subject to those tests. These are students who would normally do something called the Kappa test, which is going away, and that is not, we will probably have some replacement. And then EL students who have been here less than 12 months will not be taking these SBAC assessments. The other test that students will take will still be a CST in science. So our fifth graders, eighth graders, 10th graders will still take a science test until we've developed next generation science standards. And then we still have the CASI. That's another test that is still taken that is a proficiency for high school graduation, although there are some bills floating around in the California legislature which may change that as a requirement. I put this picture up here because I think one of the things that we have to remember is we have these Common Core standards that are expectations for college and career readiness, something I'm going to talk about a little later when we talk about CTE. And the whole idea is to give teachers the tools they need so that those standards match what students actually leave high school with, that they actually leave high school with the abilities to go to colleges and careers. The SBAC organization has provided us with three really nice things. One is the one that will get all the attention up above, the summative test. It's the one that will rate our districts eventually. It'll be determining our API if we still do that. It'll be what parents will look at the end of the year and in the summer and see whether their children are at grade level. It will be the things that our teachers will use and our schools will use. We'll get rated on those. But I'm actually more excited about those bottom two boxes because I think they will provide the best tools for actually achieving what we need to be doing. We will be given, and we have been given, and it will only grow, a battery of interim assessments. And the whole idea of an interim assessment is to have some test questions, some assessment activities that match what will happen at the end of the year with summative assessments, but they might match it in smaller discrete parts. And so I think of myself when I decided, probably foolishly, to reactivate my grandfathered well at my house and do it myself. And I'm not a plumber. But to put a submersible pump and trench and build these pipes and put it all in there, if I had decided to do that big project and then just bury the pipes and just turn it on and hope it worked, I would have a very poor summative evaluation. But I did a lot of interim assessments over the course of that project. You know, I'm not a very good plumber, so I checked constantly whether I was going to develop leaks in my pipe system before I buried it underground. And I didn't know a lot about 110 versus 220 volts and the types of circuit breakers I would need to put in and those kinds of things. So I did a lot of painful tests to get to the place where I have a really nice well. Likewise, I think these interim assessments are going to provide our teachers the because assessment somehow is a bad word, and I don't understand why it should be a bad word. It will provide our teachers with the the material they need to find out how their students are doing on the fly. And there's some fantastic assessments that SBAC has given us for the interim. These can be used as a district, but they can also just be used by individual teachers. They're flexible. They're open. Some of them are able to be scored automatically, just as the summative tests would be, but others, you know, teachers would need to do some scoring and use rubrics themselves. But the whole idea is to be able to teach a unit of study, give a test that matches the end-of-the-year test, and find out where students are at the moment. So that group of students who is way ahead can target some different types of instruction. Those five or six students that didn't get it, something's going to have to happen before moving on, and certainly before they get to those end-of-the-year assessments. So it's really powerful. The other thing that is going to become more and more powerful is this thing called the digital library that SBAC has given us. And Mrs. Holmes, I don't have a clicker. If you can just click on to the next thing. I just did a couple screenshots. The digital library is a source that, again, is available for all teachers. And basically, it is a growing library of resources that have to do with the Common Core curriculum and the Smarter Balance assessment. You could filter and choose from all kinds of different types of resources. So, for example, if a principal in a staff meeting wanted to just say, well, let's, before we go into spring testing, let's just remind everybody what's going to happen with this SBAC test. They can go choose a resource, and if you click the next one, they could choose a video of understanding the Smarter Balance summative assessments. Click play, it's a little YouTube video, and teachers can watch it. Or a teacher teaching a unit might not have the resources they need. We hear teachers saying, I just don't have the curriculum I need for this particular thing. A teacher can go into this digital library, which will only grow, and find items that are made by teachers, created by teachers, and reviewed by teachers to teach a particular concept in the Common Core. So if you click that next one, Mrs. Holmes, if a teacher, this would look like it'd be maybe a middle school or a sixth grade assignment, one of three of the Common Core standards have to do with the ability to take evidence from different sources and make judgments about that evidence. And this is a nice little 45-minute, one-period unit that a teacher could pull up, and it's actually, you know, it's kind of fascinating to read it. But the unit had to do with whether the media is exacerbating issues of NFL players abusing their spouses and domestic children, or helping with the awareness. And so you could, it's timely. It's created by teachers, and this will only grow as a resource. So, very happy that this is available. We just started training teachers, I believe, last week on some of the digital library, the interim assessments. Our fantastic staff in ISLA will be going out and sharing that information. So I just wanted to give you that. And in the next couple of meetings, we'll talk a little bit about SBAC and give you some sample questions. We'll let you guys play around with what that test will actually look like. The only other thing I want to mention in my report is that we are well on our way with our LCAP reach out. We've hit almost half of the schools, I think, at this point. We finished our survey of middle school and high school students. It was fascinating to go and hear all of our students and get feedback from them. We spoke to about 200 kids and had some really good feedback from all different walks of middle school and high school life about what their experience is in their schools. We 2 weeks ago, we had the opportunity to do our presentation and get feedback from our PTA Boosters organization and parents. So the reach out is in earnest so that we can come up with a plan in the next 6 weeks or so. That's what I got.
Thank you, Mr. Quisenberry.
There may be a question in here somewhere, but it's more of an observation. I was a little surprised that the SBAC or this assessment is not assessing 9th and 10th graders. It's jumped to the 11th grade. And my recollection of the CSTs was there used to be a somewhat of 11th grade drop-off in scores.
Yeah,
and so my observation about that is, you know, they're focused on PSATs or SATs, and there's a certain amount of ennui and skepticism, and I don't think it was necessarily attributable to it being more abstract or what have you. I just kind of think that I thought that was an interesting choice to pick the 11th grade. I think they've got usually bigger fish to fry.
Well, and we have the same concerns of 2 years without a summative assessment in high school. And so all the more reason why those interim assessments can be really important to make sure that our 9th and 10th graders are keeping up with those expectations, and our 9th and 10th grade teachers are keeping up with the expectations that their 11th grade cohort is going to have to be responsible for. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments by the board?
And I think further exasperating this is something that Rick mentioned, but we need to maybe pay attention to. As the state and our staff and the country made this switch to Common Core, and the universities have made this switch, and the SATs have made this switch, somehow the state forgot to work on the CASI. So, as Rick said, it may get canceled, suspended for 2 years, which is another assessment that we had that we may not have for a while. So it's, I don't know how they missed that, but oh well.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. Next is our Measure D update. Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so two things, you know, and one will come in as a resolution to you, and that's for our recommendations for our Citizens Bond Oversight Committee. Very pleased with our candidates. Really some outstanding individuals that I look forward to working with, and so that will come to the board as a resolution later in the meeting, as well as the bylaws. Dr. Prater and myself both got to go to San Francisco last week for our bond rating meeting. So basically, you have, as part of the process of selling the bonds, you go, and as a district, we get rated, kind of like a credit score. And so we attended two different ones, one with S&P, one with Moody's. And just what I can tell the public and what I can tell you is both, I would say, overwhelmingly positive response from both rating agencies, just and mainly, I would say, because of the financial shape that the board has kept us in over the years. So even with our struggles for a few years, with the cuts and reductions that we had to take, it really kind of showed, as you look at our past history and where we are today, that the board has done a great job of really managing our finances, keeping us in a great spot. And so that was a real positive thing for both agencies. You know, I hopefully we'll have some really high scores. What that means, if we have a good rating based on these great things that we've been able to do as a district, that just it helps lower the amount or cost of the bonds to the taxpayer. So really, by you doing your job, us getting a good rating will then be a benefit to the taxpayers as they pay back. So kind of like getting a car loan, the lower interest rate because you have good credit. You know, you pay less in interest. So it's the same type of thing. So getting that good rating will mean that the interest payment back on the loans will be a lot less. So we should know March 9th, have some indication of where we're at with that. And so when we are notified, we'll let the board know and share that at the next meeting as well.
Great. Okay. Questions, comments from the board?
I just would say that, you know, we have probably made some good decisions, but we've made them on the basis of excellent guidance. I think during the time I've been on the board, we've had people in positions to be guiding us about our fiscal policies, and I'm just really grateful. I'm really grateful that we had smart people that were talking whispering in our ears.
Anyone else? All right, item 8.01, the second interim financial report. Here comes Julie. We're so excited.
You know, this is the best part of the night, isn't it? This is much better than those teach things. Well, I'm very happy to report that we, again, have a positive certification for our second interim. That means that our district is in good financial shape for second interim. We can meet our financial obligations this year and the next 2 years, and we can maintain our 10% reserve for economic uncertainties.
And we have some graphs that actually are included in your narrative, so you can follow along if you'd like. And we just kind of go over what the changes have been since first interim and look at our multi-year projection again. And then we're going to take a little look at how we rate as a basic aid compared to how we would rate as a LCFF district. Kim, could you change the slide? Thank you. So if you look at our revenues, you can see that the difference between second interim and first interim was not really that dramatic. Our total revenues went up by $315,000, mostly because of our local revenues, which always go up. That also includes that bus grant, so they went up even a little bit more than usual. But you see in the federal revenues that decrease is because of the MA funding that Ryan was talking about. We took out everything but what we know we're going to get this year. And we took it out in our multi-year projection as well, which you'll see coming up. In the expenditure categories, we did our due diligence and tried to make some cuts to our expenditures. Had to increase some salary and benefit expenses. The benefits went up partly because of our the excess sick leave that we ended up paying because we've had a lot of retirees. So that went up more than we budgeted. Our books and supplies, that gets budgeted to the different categories, and we also made some cuts, as you'll see on the next page. And then capital outlay, that's that bus grant again. It was over $300,000 that we increased the budget there for capital outlay. So between the revenues and the expense, we were able to actually increase our ending balance by about $792,000. And this is a list of the specific items that affected the ending balance. So for instance, you can see that our general fund legal services, we need to make a little bit of an increase to that. Our salary and benefit adjustments were in there. That was a decrease to our ending balance. Our developer fees have been coming in quite a bit more. So as you may know, we can take 3% of our developer fees and transfer it to the general fund for administrative costs. So we made an adjustment for that. Didn't look like we were going to be using all of our furniture budget, so we reduced that, and we also reduced utilities. We felt like that was over-budgeted a bit. There's the excess sick leave and the catastrophic leave that we've been using. We have fewer combo classes, so we won't be paying as much in stipends, so we reduced that. And then the preschool expense was something that we had budgeted in lottery, and then with the LCAP, we moved it over to the supplemental portion of the LCAP, where we have that separated into its own budget. But we didn't really have anything to replace it in lottery, and we can track it very specifically. So we put the preschool expense back into lottery. So it was really a savings to our general fund because it was almost sort of double budgeted. We weren't using that portion of lottery. We have that Microsoft voucher money, so we're able to move some software expense to that and also to lottery. And as you can see at the bottom, there were some reductions because of the MA expense and then just some other balancing items.
Could we just go back for a second? Ellen? Okay, thanks. It sounds like some of this is ongoing, possibly, and some of it's one time. But, you know, it wasn't too long ago we cut $8 million and we hit some projects with that that are near and dear to me and maybe some of the other board members. So with this $800,000, do we get to refund anything, or are we...
This does is it reduces our budgeted expenses.
Okay, so the current budget.
Well, actually, this includes revenues, too. So this is really just, if you looked at the ending balance at first interim, it's $700,000 more now. But it was just reducing things that we analyzed and thought, okay, like our utilities, we probably were over-budgeted there. There were some things in the LCAP that we looked at and thought, well, we're probably not going to get to that this year, so let's take that out of the budget. So we could get a little bit closer to where we are at the end of the year.
Okay, and so... actually one of my pet things, the utilities, we over-budgeted. So as we go in forward with the next 7 years, I can't do the next 7 days in my budget, but is that something that we would see adjusted in the future if it...
Oh, sure.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and this is, you know, we're still budgeting. It's still an estimate. By the end of the year, we may save more than that. We're just not sure.
Great.
You know, with the rain, maybe we won't use as much water.
So just to tie into to Mr. Bergman's question, so we have a deficit right now that shows on the books. So we just lowered that deficit by $791,000. So, you know, we're still, if you just look at our, you know, our conservative kind of analysis right now, if we spent every penny that we have, you know, encumbered, we would basically be about $4 million spending more than we take in. So it was $4.8 million. Now it's $4 million, which I will tell you is almost exactly where we were at this time last year. So we don't spend every penny that we encumber, right? And so this was Julie's, you know, we need to do a better job of kind of scrubbing the budget throughout the year, so that we can kind of try to get that number to as realistic as possible when we come forward with the next budget. But absolutely, I would say in terms of the utilities, very important for us to look at what our costs were over the past 2 years. You know, things like rain. The fact that it's raining and we have our sensors now in our fields that are showing that we have enough moisture levels and we don't need to turn the sprinklers on. So it's... You know, those should be substantial savings for us as we move forward. So it's great.
Can I ask a question?
Mr. Unger.
So some of this money, we talk about a deficit, but we also know that in the end there's unallocated money that will drop to the bottom, which will eliminate the deficit, right? Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering is, if the state reserve cap ever is enforced, all of a sudden that money goes away, and then we're really deficit spending. Is that a fair way of looking at it? If all of those things count toward our reserves as we think they, as the law is currently written, mm-hmm. so they talk about the reserves plus any unallocated money at the end.
Mm-hmm.
What does that do to our financial position? What would our financial position look like if the reserve cap actually was triggered? Can you just give me a rough idea?
So two things to that. So currently in the next general fund summary, we'll kind of discuss that, right? What our ending balance would look like at the end of this year. And then, of course, we set aside what that 10% of that ending balance based on our expenditures, right? For our 10% reserve level that the board set, I found out in unaudited actuals 08-09, I found out is when the board set that 10% reserve level. And so, you know, if it was only 3%, like the mandated, you know, what basically what they're talking about, or 6%, right, double possibly the limit, then that would mean that all of that extra funds would have to be, you know, allocated somewhere. So which could, you know, mean that we would have to expend those funds and not have a future reserve. So, I mean, to me, that's a horrible thing. So the other part, too, is ongoing, looking at our future liabilities and looking at the seven-year budget and the things that Julie's going to show you in a minute, you know, that reserve level gets cut dramatically over time if we don't, you know, make sure that we're staying on top of this on a, you know, an annual basis, I think. So I don't know if that totally answers your question, but we would have to allocate all of the money somewhere, except for the, you know, whatever the mandated reserve would be.
And then I guess what I'm thinking is that money that we reallocate from year to year, we wouldn't have that money to reallocate.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying it almost is we lose the savings account we have.
Yes.
Part of that savings account being the unallocated funds at the end of the year, right? We don't have any way of getting that back. And so we really potentially could become in a world of hurt, and our deficit spending would, and I know this is going to sound funny, would be real.
Yes.
Because we wouldn't be able to count on unallocated funds at the end of the year, right?
Well, and being solely tied to property taxes now.
Okay.
I mean, if something were to happen in terms of property tax rates or property values going down, you know, having any type of cushion would be gone. And I mean, it was a critical thing in our bond rating discussion, I will say. Having the reserves that we have helped us immensely in terms of their rating. So I can't imagine what they're going to do if that was something that was, you know, a capped rate that everyone had to adhere to. So it's going to be interesting as it unfolds.
I don't really have an answer to that either, but I could probably add that I think we'll have some options as far as assigning funds or committing funds, or they would still be in that set aside. We wouldn't be spending them, but we'd be able to say we're going to use these funds for something. I think it's just basically the unassigned funds that you can't have as your reserve. But like I said, I don't know. I don't know how it's all going to pan out. So on our general fund summary, we have our first column, which is our unaudited actuals from last year, which is kind of nice to see because that's probably more realistic how we're actually going to end the year. You can see that I think our revenues are probably pretty close except for our other local revenue, which will probably go up. I don't think it's going to go up to the $5.4 million that it was at unaudited actuals just because we had some one-time grants in there last year. I could see it going up another $300,000 probably this year. Our certificated salaries for second interim don't include any of the increases, so those will go up before the end of the year. And, of course, when salaries go up, benefits also go up. Supplies, there's that $1 million that we saved in our supplies from first interim to second interim. And you can see that the effect of the changes means that our revenue over our expense or our deficit went down by about $800,000. We have our transfers in from Fund 20 after that, and then our transfers out back to Fund 20. So we're sort of just doing we're paying for our benefits, but then we're refunding the Fund 20 to pay for future benefits. And so it leaves an ending balance at second interim of $15,457,000. Now, as you mentioned, we probably will not spend every penny of this, and I could see probably that going up to at least $17 million by the end of the year. And keep in mind that some of that will be spoken for, some of that will be carryover that has to be used for a specific purpose in the next year.
I think the key to this slide, too, is really the benefit cost. So, again, we've talked about it a lot. You know, the PERS and STIRS going up a little bit each year, health benefits going up each year. But, I mean, you can physically see it now. Right? I mean, almost $1 million in that category from a year to the next year. And we haven't increased staff that much. So those are dramatic increases that we're going to have to address when we put together our budget for 15-16. And so, again, not for fear tactics, not for anything like that, but just the fact that those are increased costs, and Julie has a slide later on about it, that you know, are affecting the district's overall budget and also affecting employees. So employees are also, as the district increases, they're also paying more because they, after the first $5,000, they pay half as well. So that's a tough thing for employees because they don't, you know, they're just seeing it affect their check and not necessarily seeing the big picture of the effect on the budget as well. And even for STIRS, I think this next year is their last year where employees will have kind of their final increase in their own STIRS contribution. And then the district continues to rise, and PERS continues to rise over the next 6 years. So, and we have a chart that will show that in a little bit. Next page.
Okay, so as you know, from that ending balance, we do have things that we have to set aside, like our 10% reserve for economic uncertainty and certain things that we can't really spend. We have our restricted ending balances. We have those flexible resource balances, which we certainly don't want to use for other purposes because we need those, like to fund our adult ed program and future instructional materials. The lottery funding is that 1 year in reserve that we hold on to, so that'll be the funds that we spend next year. We still have our catastrophic leave balance. There's some money in the Ed Protection Act, which will probably help offset the raise. And at the time we did second interim, SEIU had reached their agreement, so we set aside some money for that, although it's not in the salaries yet, and we thought we'd set aside here until we can get it into the budget. So our unappropriated balance at second interim is $2,252,000. And then if you look at the multi-year projection, I feel like we've gone over this quite a few times, but just to go over one more time what our assumptions are here. Our revenue limit, that's our LCFF funding, which is actually our property taxes, and there's actually some other things included in that, but we're projecting our property taxes up by 2%, so that's pretty conservative. Federal revenues are going to go down because of that MA money. We took that out of the budget in the future because it's just too unpredictable. And we made an adjustment to state revenues, too. The ERMS money that we get for mental health services is also kind of, the SELPA is looking at different ways of reimbursing districts for that. So we've reduced that a little bit. We may not get quite as much as we have in the past. And again, the salary and benefit, well, the benefits reflect the changes we know about, but the salaries do not reflect any increases other than step and column. And an offset for 10 retirements in both certificated and classified. So by 15-16, we are able to still maintain our 10% for economic uncertainty and pay all our bills. So that's why we have a positive certification. Next
slide.
Mr.
Buckland.
On page 3 of 9. I think it's page 3 of 9. Trying to do this with my computer numbering the pages. Under the assumptions on revenue, I didn't quite understand this one. So, and I don't know if I need to read the whole thing or if I'll just ask you a question.
Sure.
Okay. So I'm looking at this, and it looks to me like it's saying if the district gets its categoricals are frozen and Bellevue Santa Fe has provided funds on the new LCFF funding calculations. But really what they do is they get part of our property tax, and so does Bellevue Santa Fe and therefore all charter schools pretty much are not affected by LCFF? Does their funding change? Or
Their funding did change.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting because we renegotiated the contract with them at the same time the LCFF went into effect. So they've always gotten part of our property taxes.
Right.
But now they're funded under LCFF, which means they're getting that gap funding rate, which is increasing it, you know, substantially every year. So the amount that we're actually giving them in property taxes is quite a bit more than it used to be.
Okay, so
we're kind of making up for what the state isn't giving them in categoricals in a way.
Okay, so let me just ask, this is the last question of the last sentence of the section. This transfer to Bellevue Santa Fe decreases the district's LCFF / revenue limit funding. It always has, and it's not.
It always has.
And so at LCFF, if we were to be able
right.
to, okay.
LCFF.
It just sounded like they were somehow getting under the wire for LCFF.
I guess what I was trying to do is explain why it doesn't look like our property taxes are going up 2% there, because really the LCFF funding includes more than just property taxes. It includes that transfer to Bellevue Santa Fe and also our categorical funding.
But they have a target and a gap as well. So just like the LCFF, so they, over the next 6 years, they are going to be increase their LCFF amount, and what we have to pay them is going to increase as their LCFF increases as well. So it's it's not just like a stable amount. We have to, Julie has to plan that into the assumptions as well.
Mr. Millar?
That was an excellent question, Mark, and it's kind of where I was going to. In the past, we had the agreement that that established the amount of monies that we would provide. So how is our total pie of property tax revenue, how is the share that goes to Bellevue Santa Fe calculated? Are they essentially a revenue limit district with?
Yes.
So eventually their per pupil amount has the potential to exceed the per pupil amount of the rest of our students in our district?
I don't see that happening because they don't get really any categorical funding anymore at all, and they used to.
That's we're not going to get much either, though.
And they don't have their unduplicated percentage, if you know what that is, for the LCFF.
Right.
It's very low.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that they would.
Right. So they're going to kind of be in the same boat we are, but except their target
different.
Funding is going to go up. Ours is going to, we'll get to that chart later on, is going to, until 2015-16, is going to stay below our revenue limit amount.
Right.
So
their funding is now calculated based on LCFF and doesn't really have anything to do with basic aid other than they're getting property taxes from our district.
Okay. And do we participate or approve their LCFF funding plan?
Their LCAP?
I don't. Are they?
Yes, we.
Their LCAP. Okay.
I don't know that we. Do we approve it? The county approves it, but we have to review their LCAP.
Okay.
Right.
Good.
I understand.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Anything else?
Thank
Julie?
You. Oh, I think, yes. I think there's another slide.
I did have. Oh. Were you going to get down to that diagram?
There's actually two more slides, yeah.
On page 5 of 9. That was the. That's the one.
The LCFF, yeah.
Right. I'm looking at kind of the report, and one question I think would be fairly easy to deal with. In the paragraph just above that on page 6 of 9, it looks like, it makes reference to the school services dartboard. Is that a misprint?
Yes.
Where does it say that? I'm sorry. School services, what is it?
Under percentage of gap funding.
The school services dartboard.
Dartboard.
Is what they call it.
Yeah.
It's what they call it.
A dartboard. Okay. Oh, wow, yeah, that inspires confidence. I was hoping it was a misprint dashboard.
They're a pretty good shot. Well, they're a pretty good shot.
That's the title. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And Julie gets to throw the darts. That would
be
fair.
That was
so, so this chart indicates that we could actually, if we have 2% growth as we're assuming or less, that we could actually become a revenue limit district.
Yeah.
With our relatively low revenue limit amount. It used
to. Well, no, it's all different now.
So we're not stuck with the $7,600 bucks per student.
We would be an LCFF district and be funded basically exactly like every other school district in the state, other than the supplemental and concentration grant funding, which is based on our unduplicated count.
And we don't have that much. Yeah, I mean, for me, this is a form of coming full circle, because probably 17, 18 years ago during Strategy 14, we were planning for legislative fiat, doing away with our basic aid status. And that led to the discussion about larger reserves and a lot of issues like that. So I'm hoping that that's off the table after we beat it back the last time with the Coalition for Sound Education, I think it was. But it's very interesting to see that we're arriving at the same destination, but through such a convoluted means. We'll see what the future holds when happens, if I'm around.
It could be good for everyone, because everyone's going to be funded the same way, and everyone will be at that level instead of there being, you know, like Ryan says, there won't be that difference in our funding and everyone else's, and it'll take the target off of us.
Yeah. Okay.
So they call it a dartboard on purpose.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, school services, it truly is a dartboard. I mean, they're guesstimating what's going to happen next year, the following year, how much the governor's going to put in the budget. I mean, they literally call it a dartboard, I think, for that reason. And knowing Ron Bennett and John Gray and the likes, I'm sure that they did that on purpose.
Well, I'm reassured that it was not a typo on our part.
That's very good. So the key, though, I would say, if you look at the chart, what I'd like to, you know, for the board to get from this is the fact that should the economy stay positive, should everything remain fantastic and great and all the revenues are coming into the state, they will continue to fund the gap, right? So the green line is where we would actually be if we were not basic aid. So it's still a substantial drop, $13, $14, $17 million less than what we currently receive in property tax revenues. And even in 16-17, with some major influx of funds, still close to, you know, $9 million in 16-17. Now, why is that important for us? Is you'll see our blue line doesn't change that much. So we're seeing districts around us getting a huge influx of new funds. Some. Atascadero, Templeton, some districts, not as much. Declining enrollment, don't have the unduplicated count, not as great. But other districts are getting huge influxes. So that is something we're going to really have to explain to our staff and our parents and the public, that we're on a much more stable path than seeing huge influxes, I think, over time. So it's just something that's going to, you know, I think we need to talk about it. Now, the great part about that target getting funded is it does help us and lessens our, our fall should something dramatic happen to us, right? So it is a positive in that means, I would say. And again, the target, the red line, is not where the funds are at. The funds are at the green line. So it's, you know, there's still a pretty wide gap as we move forward, and it'll be really interesting to see how positive the economy stays and whether that gap funding continues at the pace that it is currently.
I would just point out that when falling, once you reach terminal velocity, the remaining distance you fall is kind of academic.
Okay, we have Marilyn and Chris.
Thank you. Thank you for explaining about this chart, because I misinterpreted the chart and I thought that we were dangerously close to the LCFF amount, and I was just made myself feel better by deciding that the 2% that we've projected for property tax increases is an extremely conservative number.
Yes.
So it, in all likelihood, it will be greater than that. Whether it's significantly greater,
probably
I don't
not.
Know, but it will be greater than that. And then the other thing was, and I see that Julie managed to work her magic on this one.
Yes, actually,
but
Andy,
under the supplemental and concentration funding, the even though we don't qualify for any of these monies, I still think that it's really important to take note of the fact that we have, mm-hmm. in San Luis Coastal, an unduplicated percentage of 41%
yes.
of students who are either socioeconomically disadvantaged, English language learners, or foster homeless youth. 41% of our students. Mm-hmm. So that's a number that, you know, I think we need to emphasize and remind ourselves that, you know, it's a very large percentage that we are trying mm-hmm. to serve and you know, figure out how their circumstances can be improved through our efforts. Thank you.
Mr. Unger.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to that chart. I think the important thing for me to remember, and perhaps for other people to remember, is we're already there. Mm-hmm. We don't have to get there. And unless circumstances change dramatically, we won't. And my understanding is that we're about districts are now about 2/3 of the way toward their full LCFF funding, which was dramatic because of the increases in state revenue this year. And whether that can continue or not over the next 5 to 6 years is that's going to be the dartboard, right? We can only hope the economy continues to expand, but you know, there's not that much optimism about a continued increase in the economy over time. You know, there's always bumps. So I think we, as long as our property taxes remain good, as long as PG&E remains healthy, I think hopefully we get to stay in a pretty good position.
I think there's one.
So we included
slide.
The last slide. Okay. So Kim will pull it up. But this is again why it's going to be so important for us to speak with our employees, to discuss compensation, to look at the picture of the budget. Because and the reason why I put this together is just a graphic representation of what's happening in terms of comparing our total revenue, which is the very top bar, with our salaries and personnel costs. And so the red bar is the certificated salaries. and classified salaries. And then when we add on the benefits, that's the green, it raises up to the green bar, and that's workers' compensation, unemployment, all of the other benefits that employees get. Then you add the STIRS and PERS cost, which is the purple line added to that, and you see that dramatic increase over the time, right, of what happens with those costs. And then the last one is the health costs. And so health care, it's unbelievable how much it's going up. And that's the one I think that scares me the most, because, again, not only is that chart going up for us as a district, but it's the employees are also going up. So that $3 million increase we're seeing over this time period, employees are also paying another $3 million out of their check. So this is across the state. This is everyone has to deal with this, has to encounter it, but it really is something that we have to, I think, get together with our employees, talk about. Are there better ways of doing this? And instead of, you know, maybe putting the money towards a benefit, is it better to put it salary or health care savings plans or doing? I mean, we just need to talk about it and kind of get ideas out, I think. Because unless the state does something to help us with this, I think every district across California is in a world of hurt come 2021. And what happens is when that gap narrows to that amount, as we know, because we dealt with it a couple years ago, your personnel cost just gets so high that you can't function. You can't pay all the other bills to run the school district. So, again, hopefully property taxes will increase and that top bar will go higher than the 2% that we've planned and life will be great. But if not, we really need to, again, because there's no raises put into that over the next 6 years, right? So it's just something we're going to have to constantly talk about and discuss, because I don't know that they get it. Where they understand what's been, you know, put in place and how it affects them and how it affects the district. So we just have to work together, and I'll try to do a lot of that next year, getting out, talking to sites, talking to staffs, and doing whatever I can.
Marilyn?
That is a really great graphic.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know who takes ownership for that.
Mandy Dawson.
Okay. It is really great, easy to understand, and shocking. Are you taking that around on your LCAP discussions?
No, not yet.
Okay.
We do the 7-year plan, though. 7-year budget, we do. As well as our fund balance history.
Which is all great,
yes.
but it's not as simple as that. I mean, that just really tells the story. Mm-hmm. That's a terrific graphic. Hats off to Mandy.
Yeah. Anyone else?
I would just love to see this not only shared with our staff and our school community, but I think this is important for the community at large to see what our school funding looks like.
Yeah.
Because as Brian points out, when we start getting into 18, 19, 20, and our personnel percentages go high, we need to prepare the community for what this is going to look like. It's not a pretty picture, but thank you, and thanks to Mandy for putting this together.
So I will say, as we go into this budget cycle coming up, so we really, you know, through attrition, through looking at program, those types, anything we can do to ease that, mm-hmm. are things that we should look at, and we'll be bringing, you know, information to the board to share, and trying to, again, also doing those proactive things. Like the water meters, like ways to decrease utility. I mean, you know, it's twofold, right, in terms of looking at whatever cost we can. But the personnel cost in particular is probably the most scary out of all of the things that we pay for.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Oh, that's all I have.
Okay. Well, then... we have as item, we have the resolution,
right.
And
it's a roll call.
You've made your presentation. Is there anyone from the public who would like to address this before we take the resolution? All right, seeing no one, if we could have a motion to accept the resolution regarding the second interim financial report. Mr. Quisenberry.
I move that we accept the resolution for the second interim financial report.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All right, Mrs. Holmes, your resolution magic, please.
Mr. Questenberry.
Aye.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
Aye.
Mr. Buckman.
Yes.
Mrs. Roger.
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer.
Yes.
Mr. Millar.
Aye.
Mr. Unger.
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
All right. Our next item, 8.02, Measure D appointments to the Citizens Bond Oversight Committee. I see we have some oversight present here this evening.
Mr. Sanfilippo is here. He's one of our potential bond oversight committee individuals. So, Kim, if you can pull that up. So we had, I'm really excited to be on, as I mentioned earlier, about this group, not only because of the diversity of the people, they represent all of our communities. So we're represented from Morro Bay and Los Osos and Avila Beach and San Luis Obispo, which was fantastic. People with a lot of experience in being on committees and tied to education. And we have a couple of CPAs and just a really great group of individuals that I really look forward to working with. And again, the as you'll see in the bylaws at the next resolution, really is to kind of be that oversight body for the public to ensure that all of the bond funds that the district receives are being spent as the proposition said they were supposed to be. So we'll be working with them, giving them all the financial information, and then once a year they will be coming to the board and issuing kind of a report to the board, to the public, about their findings, about the budget, how the money's spent, and again, whether or not the district is doing as they were supposed to do. So the individuals that are recommended here today, I think, are going to be great choices for us, and I look forward to working with them.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this? I'll bring it back to the board.
Ryan, could you just tell us how frequently will they be meeting and what will the content of those meetings
so,
be like?
You know, it'll be a little slow to start because a lot of projects and things haven't picked up. So I would assume probably a couple of times a year. So it's really going to be up to the Bond Oversight Committee. I mean, getting together with them, kind of talking to them. I would see them probably getting together, you know, probably one time soon, maybe once in the summer, and then again in the fall for this, in terms of this year, because we'll want to put that report together for the board before the end of the year. And then, you know, probably a quarterly after that, quarterly updates, working, getting all of the budget information, everything through Julie Avnet, through Spectrum Solutions, sharing that with the bond oversight. And then, of course, once projects begin, taking them out to the sites, and you know, so we're not just saying we're doing these things, but they can actually physically go out and see that the construction is happening and all the things that that we're talking about in those meetings are going on.
Okay, Mr. Buckman.
Madam Chair, thank you. This is a thankless task. It's going to be a lot of numbers. It's going to be. Mm-hmm. So I congratulate everybody that stepped forward. I did notice that, I'm sorry I can't access my stuff right now and I can't read that far away, but two of the folks are working at the same firm?
Yes, Glenn okay. Burdett.
And we're okay? In terms of the people, in terms of the law?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Millar.
Well, I was reassured to see Ken Sanfilippo's name on the list. He qualifies for the Benjamin Button Award. He seems to be younger looking than when I last saw him some time ago.
Retired.
I wonder what that has. Yeah, I was going to say. And thanks, Ken, again, for serving the district as you have so many times in the past. And if anyone else is here, I think we should acknowledge him. Okay. Thanks, Ken.
Marilyn?
We've gone to the board and gone to the public. Is it time for someone to move the resolution?
It is time.
Okay, I'd be delighted to move resolution number 12-14-15, resolution of the Board of Education of San Luis Coastal Unified School District confirming appointment of Citizens Oversight Committee members.
I will second that.
Any further discussion? All in, Mrs. Holmes?
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
And I would also just take a quick moment to thank everyone who will be serving on this committee. We'll look forward to your reports, and hopefully it will be as much a learning opportunity for you as Measure D is proving to be for me.
Yes.
All right. Item 8.03, Measure D, the bylaws, which...
So, again, working with Jones Hall, our bond firm, we put together some bylaws, pretty standard in terms of length. What I'd like to do is have the board adopt these tonight. I will be meeting with the Bond Oversight Committee very soon, setting up a time with them, reviewing these bylaws. If there's anything that, in terms of changes or things that they would like to see, I'll absolutely bring that back to the board at some time. But I think having this initial set of bylaws established will be a positive step for us to kind of guide us in the right direction.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to discuss this resolution? All right, Mark.
Thanks, Ryan. Let me repeat back what I think you just heard. We'd like it approved the way it is now, but if we have changes we'd like in the future, we can ask about it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks.
But wouldn't such changes, they would come from the committee?
Oh, well... Can I just throw something out?
Yeah, absolutely.
Consideration. Mm-hmm. Item 3.2, review of expenditures. Mm-hmm. It looks like the committee's going to get quarterly expenditure reports. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, and I don't think it needs to even be in the bylaws, I was just wondering if I, as one board member, could get a copy of those.
I think you're going to, this is just the Bond Oversight Committee, so I plan on updating you probably even more so than what you're seeing here.
Can I get less
then? You can. Absolutely.
Thanks.
So, yeah, everything that's shared will definitely be available to the board.
Okay, thank
you. And to be honest with you, most of it will be on our website and available to the public as well. I mean, we'll make sure that we get everything out and try to educate the public as well as we move forward.
Marilyn.
Thank you. I'm trying to find where I thought that I read... meetings once a year. Mrs. Sheffer just told me in a stage whisper that was a meeting a minimum of once a year.
Minimum.
Okay. Oh, I don't. Okay, regular meetings. The committee is required to meet at least once a year, including an annual organizational meeting to be held at a time, I guess, to be determined.
I would hope that if we have a bond oversight committee that they'll meet at least annually. I hope they elect to do so.
There's no necessity to say, well, the people who would be coming on to a bond oversight committee have full awareness that they'll be meeting more than once a year because
absolutely.
We don't want anyone to be shocked.
Yes. And so I'll be talking to them. And again, I think sitting down with the committee and talking to them about how many meetings they need. What do they need in terms of meeting and when we're in the crux of major construction and lots going on, maybe it's monthly. Whatever we need to do to ensure that they feel up to date and knowledgeable about where we're at and how the money is being spent, we will do it.
Okay, Chris, then Mark.
Well, I was going to say that this is a set of bylaws we're being asked to approve, mm-hmm. Which is going to be essentially the policy of the committee. Mm-hmm. My guess, my expectation, I would imagine anyway, is that the committee itself, in concordance with the staff, will come up with some policies and procedures, which will be the guidelines under which, or the standing rules, under which the committee will organize and act. So, I think I'm perfectly comfortable with the bylaws as is, and then understanding that you guys are going to come up with your own standing rules or policies and procedures that will help guide how you operate.
Absolutely.
So I'm ready to make a motion.
Did you have anything further? Okay. Any further discussion? Right, Mark?
I'd like to make a motion to approve Resolution 13-14-15, resolution of the Board of Education to approve the bylaws for the Citizens Oversight Committee.
Okay, and I'll second that.
Okay, motion and a second. Mrs. Holmes.
Mr. Buckman?
Aye.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Okay, next on the agenda, item 9.01, proposed SEIU agreement. Okay, this is opening the public hearing. Opening.
I don't necessarily need to stand up here, except okay. For it is a public hearing, and so this is the opportunity for the public to take any, make any comments about the approval of the SEIU agreement. But I would like to say that we're pleased that we were able to reach a tentative agreement with SEIU as the first unit to conclude negotiations. We appreciate them for that.
Thank you. Anyone wishing to speak to this? We will close the public hearing. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And before moving on to our discussion items, we will take a 5-minute break at the request of a board member who shall remain anonymous. So it is, we'll be back at a few minutes before 8 o'clock.
I need to stand 8 o'clock. Up.
And looking forward to item 10.01, reading recovery mid-year review.
Good evening, board. My name is Amy Shields, elementary director. It is my pleasure to introduce Mary Zerm, our reading recovery teacher leader, to provide for you mid-year data on reading recovery.
Hi again. Hi. Thank you so much for letting me come back and share the progress of our reading recovery and DLL students this year. Okay. If anything's not on time, it's Amy. No. So she has a new clicker she's practicing. So the purpose of this presentation is to share the outcome data for the students who started in reading recovery in the fall and completed a full series of lessons. There'll be three questions that we answer this evening. One is how many students successfully discontinued from reading recovery, how many students were recommended after a full series of lessons, and then finally we're going to review change over time to figure out what have our students learned since beginning in reading recovery. After a full series of lessons, two positive outcomes can be expected. When a child's series of lessons is discontinued, the school team is making a prediction that the student's literacy processing system will continue to progress without needing further one-on-one intensive intervention. A student who's been recommended has not made adequate progress to go it alone yet, but these students will need some continued monitoring and ongoing support, either through their IEPs in special education or because we have LLI in place in our district. The Observation Survey of Early Literacy Achievement is the standardized assessment that is administered to all participating students pre-intervention, post-intervention, and then again at the end of the school year. The 6 tasks measure a student's current understandings of the items of knowledge students must master and apply when reading and writing continuous texts. These are the same literacy skills identified as high leverage by the Common Core standards and the same skills that are addressed on the first grade report card. So how did we do? 54 students have completed their reading recovery program so far. 29 of these students are English learners and 11 are students with disabilities. Of this group, 12 students made significant progress and discontinued their series of lessons. 7 of the discontinued students are English learners, supporting the effectiveness of this intervention for students in the subgroup. 40 students have been recommended for some level of continued literacy support. The DLL teachers at Pacheco work with 6 students. 4 of those students successfully discontinued their series of lessons, and 2 were recommended for continued support. Here you'll see the subgroups of students at each of our school sites. The first column shows the number of students who completed their series of lessons in reading recovery, followed by how many of these students are English learners or students with IEPs.
That's the 12 from above.
Okay. So are we seeing kids in reading recovery who are on IEPs now? Because that's a change, isn't it?
We've always seen kids with IEPs. Students will be accepted or be considered in reading recovery if they're getting their English language instruction in the first grade classroom. And so we have some students who already have IEPs, and then we also have students who reading recovery is a pre-referral intervention for them before we would refer them for assessment.
Could I ask a... It's kind of a preliminary question. In the reading recovery update discussion about the early screening or assessment, it makes reference to a minimum of 30% of the first grade students were assessed at each school site to ensure selection of the most fragile readers and writers for intervention. Is there some, ahead of the assessment, is there some recommendation of students to go into the assessment based on how they're performing?
Okay. Yes.
That's all I
need to
know.
What happens is our kindergarten teachers do what we call an alternate ranking. And so they look at each of their students in kindergarten and rank them from the students who they consider the neediest or the most fragile to the highest. And we start assessing from the lowest students and keep assessing until we really see a break in our data. Okay, so we do have that.
So in some classes you may end up with more than 30%, but others.
Correct. Okay. And it's about 30% of the population, of the first grade population at the school site, because then we also have to assess any new students that we don't have data on. We need to assess them as well.
And that's always kind of been our target, is to get those 30 percentile. Of,
right.
Great. Thank you, Mary.
You're welcome. So a third way to interpret the data is to compare how the students in San Luis Coastal compare to the students in the national random sample on each of the tasks of the observation survey. The random sample students are selected nationally from all schools that are implementing reading recovery or DLL. So here you can see what would be considered the average fall and mid-year scores for students in the national group. And now we can take a look at how our students compare to the sample group. When looking at the fall data, which is highlighted here, you'll notice that the students in and you'll see the national averages, and then you'll see our students on the bottom. You'll notice that the students in San Luis Coastal scored below the averages, national averages on all 6 tasks in the fall. This would be expected because we're identifying the lowest students in the grade level for reading recovery, that we wouldn't be serving students who are at that average or above average level. So these low scores support the need for intensive intervention for our neediest readers and writers. When we compare the fall data to the mid-year data for our students on the bottom, we can see the change over time in our students' acquisition of foundational skills and ability to read texts of increasing complexity. On all 6 tasks, the students are approaching or have met the national averages. The tasks highlighted in red are those areas where our students are now working within the national average or the average national band. While some of these scores would not discontinue a student from reading recovery or DLL, they are evidence that our students are on a trajectory toward closing the achievement gap. So these would be some of our kids who are recommended. Here you'll find the same comparison data for our English learners who were served in reading recovery. Again, the fall and mid-year data reflects a positive change in the progress of students in this subgroup. Even on the concepts about print task, which is an assessment that's very dependent on academic language, our EL students are now approaching that national average. Finally, let's see how the Spanish readers at Pacheco compared to the National DLL sample group. Interestingly, on three tasks highlighted in blue there on the bottom, the students at Pacheco fell within the average band in the fall, so on some of those tasks. And then mid-year, you again can see the students are approaching or they're meeting the national average on all six tasks. Mari Clay has always encouraged us to keep real students in mind as we think and talk about reading recovery. I'd like to take a few minutes to introduce you to a few students whose educational lives have been drastically changed because they've had the opportunity to spend 20 weeks working individually with one of our reading recovery teachers. This is Brent and Mrs. Taylor, his reading recovery teacher. Brent came to Baywood directly from the Philippines this fall. At the time of our fall assessment, he was the lowest student at the school, and the school team was questioning if he had enough English language to access this level of instruction. So remember, we don't exclude kids from reading recovery unless they're an English language learner who doesn't understand the tasks of the observation survey. So Brent was scoring very low on that, but we felt like he understood what we were asking of him, and so they started lessons. So let's see how Brent and Mrs. Taylor did. Here you see Brent's fall and mid-year data compared to the national data. His scores were low enough to indicate that he was at great risk without intensive intervention. His mid-year scores increased dramatically, and we were able to discontinue his series of lessons. His classroom teacher and the reading recovery team are predicting he'll continue to make significant literacy progress with strong classroom instruction and language development support. So here's an example of the change over time that occurred in Brent's writing development. Just in case you can't read it, on the left-hand side there, that was Brent's fall hearing and recording sounds and words. This was his attempt to write, "The bus is coming. It will stop here to let me get on." I think you can read his mid-year assessment. Okay. And when we assess the kids, we give them a different sentence. But last week when I was overseeing him, I said, "Could you write this one for me again, Brent?" He's like, "Oh, yeah, no problem." So as you can see, Brent now understands the alphabetic principle that sounds he hears can be linked to the letters on the page. Of course, our ultimate goal in reading recovery is to have our students put together all the pieces of the puzzle to problem solve the messages of increasingly complex texts. So let's see how Brent is doing.
Frog is frog in the cow. And the cow.
Okay, you got this one.
One day, a big cow came to the pond. Froggy Frog jumped up and down. "Go away, go away," he shouted. But the cow did not go away. It drank and drank. This one is kind of funny.
Okay, back to the next.
The next day, Froggy Frog called a meeting. He said, "This is or pond. The cows must not come here. How will we stop them?" asked Lizzy Lizard. "We will show them, shoo them away."
Progress was 12 text levels in 20 weeks. And when he started with us, he couldn't read our very beginning book, which is, you know, we have a book that we try to have the kids read. If they can't read it, then we read a book to them and repeat it. He couldn't repeat that story back to us, remember that pattern. So I think he was getting the message of this text. He just kept laughing about it. He thought it was so funny. So we also want to make sure that our reading recovery students have transferred what they can do in the one-to-one setting back into the large group classroom setting. Let's hear how Mrs. Slesher, Brent's teacher, feels about his progress.
Brent is a second language student in my class who came to us this year straight from the Philippines, and he's just doing amazing. I think a lot part in both from his classroom work and reading recovery has just been a huge helper in his success, just in his confidence, his ability to use reading strategies, and to write independently. He's doing amazing. So we're so thankful for this program at our school.
So I have one more friend to introduce to you. This is Nevo and Mrs. Cass, his reading recovery teacher. Nevo moved here from Israel at the beginning of the year. Again, he was the lowest of the students at his school, and again, we considered if he had enough English language to access instruction. Mrs. Cass, one of our teachers in training this year, was ready for the challenge. Together, they embarked on a very important journey. Again, Nevo's fall scores indicated he needed intensive intervention. His mid-year score shows that he made significant growth, and his series of lessons was discontinued, too. Here's another...
What was his primary language?
Hebrew. Yeah, and it was interesting because I was talking with him last week. We tried to get a little video clip. It wasn't real clear, and I said, what have you learned so far this year? And he said... He was able to tell me when he came here, he didn't understand what his teacher was saying. He didn't understand what the rest of the kids were saying, and that he tried really hard, and that he said, and then I got reading recovery, and now I read really well. So he did, and I remember assessing him at the beginning of the year, and he was really hesitant. It was obvious he had a little bit of English someplace, but he really didn't understand a lot of it. So there again. So here's a another example of the change over time that we see in our students' writing. In the fall, Nevo was asked to write all the words he knew. He was able to write two, his name and Neil. And when I asked him who Neil was, he said, that's the name of the family friend who was helping him learn letters before they moved here. You can see evidence of the things that Nevo and Neil worked on together. Mid-year, Nevo was again asked to write all the words he knew in 10 minutes. He wrote 45 accurately with many attempts that were very close, things like T-H-A-Y for they. You see that evidence of him going, oh, I've learned about what that A-Y says. He's learned how to learn words and has built a bank of known words that will serve as his foundation for problem solving. When I was talking to him the other day and I showed him these papers and I said, look what you've learned this year. And he said, would you make sure and tell those grown-ups I wrote 3 pages, not just 1 page of words? I said, sure, I'll do that. So let's take a moment and pop in and see how Nevo is doing on his reading.
Mom wanted to pull it out. Now it's different. Dad wanted to pull it out. No, it's different. Mommy went on the swing. Different pushed her. Oh no, the swing hit Skipper. Lucky was gone. Skipper had a smaller it. Skipper was upset. No tooth, no money. Sorry, said Bobby and Chip. Never mind, said Mom. Never mind, said Dad. I'm not sad. Said Skipper, I'm glad.
So reading recovery teachers must have a strong self-efficacy. Okay, that their students will develop the problem-solving strategies needed to read and write. They have to instill that same sense of efficacy in their students. The data shows that these two students are on their way as independent and confident readers and writers. So I want to thank you for this opportunity to share the progress our reading recovery and DLL students have made this year. Many of our students have made significant growth and are now working up to the average of their first grade peers. Some are on their way but have not closed the achievement gap yet.
with strong classroom instruction, research-based small interventions like LLI, continued monitoring, and that strong sense of efficacy, they will get there. For a few hours, or for a few others, they will find support through their individual education plans. For all of our students, the diagnostic teaching and reading recovery will provide a wealth of information for the teachers and specialists who will support these children in the future. Each is on a different path to a common outcome, which is literacy for all. We truly do change lives one child at a time in reading recovery. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Really glad we still have reading.
Me too.
Thank you. Let's see if there's anyone from the public who would like to talk about this. We will bring it. We will bring it back, Catherine, then Chris.
Thank you so much for that. It's so emotional. Really, it chokes me up. But Brent. Not only did he learn to read, but he just found the joy of reading, which was just—it was evident in his face. It's just delightful. And Nevo, in his writing, I was wondering, because Hebrew is read from right to left instead of left to right, right? Mm-hmm. So he was doubly challenged, and he lived up to the task, and that was just really fun to see. Thank you.
You're welcome. And he was fun when I pulled him, because when we consider a child being discontinued from reading recovery, the teacher who works with them does not get to assess them. Another teacher has to assess them. So it's like they've got to be able to do it anywhere with anyone. And so I was the teacher who worked with Nevo to assess him. And here it is. It's kind of this assessment situation. He doesn't really know me. He's seen me a few times. And we walked in, and he said, "I just love books. They're just great. Great. Read a couple of these, would you?" So it was, you could tell that he really had that great joy. And his reading recovery teacher said that his mother had said the same thing, that he's just going everywhere and reading and really finding a joy in that. So
thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, I just think, I look back to when Walter and I were kind of talking about how when we first got on the board, how there was controversy about reading recovery, and there seemed to be a split between people that supported reading recovery and people that didn't support reading recovery. And we continued forward on it, and we had to make some changes. I know when we had the terrible budget cuts back in 2000, we modified the way the program was delivered. And it's so great that we kept up with it, and it's wonderful that the changes that we made didn't negatively impact the student achievement that we're seeing. So you guys are just to be congratulated, and it's such a phenomenal program.
Thank you. And we have such amazing teachers who work so hard, and they're all finished with their first round and on to their second round of kids. So we'll have some more to report at the end of the year. So thank you.
Thank you.
More videos. That was great.
Okay.
All right. Item 10.02, Title III Program Improvement Plan. Mrs. Shields.
Mary, it's a hard act to follow.
Yes.
Those kids are a hard act. Brent and Neville
absolutely
are hard acts to follow.
I am here tonight with Dawn Addis, our K-12 English Learner Intervention Teacher on Special Assignment, to share with you our Title III Year 2 Improvement Plan and request your discussion and approval. San Luis Coastal, as you know, receives about $100,000 in Title III money each year to ensure that English learners attain English proficiency and meet the same challenging academic content and achievement standards that other students are expected to meet. Currently, we have just under 1,000 English learners in our district. As a requirement for receiving the funds, we are accountable for the various annual measurable achievement objectives, or AMAOs, that measure progress for our English learners in learning English as measured on the California English Language Development Test, or CELT, as well as academic achievement in both English Language Arts and Mathematics. A lot of acronyms there.
All districts are required to submit an improvement plan if they do not meet one or more of the AMAOs for 2 years. San Luis Coastal did not meet AMAO 2 for English learners in language instruction programs fewer than 5 years. The federal goal for 2014 on AMAO 2, less than 5 years, was 22.8%. San Luis Coastal had 20.4%. We did meet AMAO 1 for annual progress of students learning English, as well as AMAO 2 for students attaining English proficiency who have been in language instruction 5 years or more. Then there's AMAO 3. This sets yearly federal targets for English language arts and mathematics based on the old No Child Left Behind criteria. For 2014, the goal was, as you know, 100% of students, including all English learners, would demonstrate proficiency in English language arts and mathematics. The goal was never measured as a result of the termination of the Standardized Testing and Reporting System, STAR. So San Luis Coastal also had not met the federal goal of 89% set back for 2013, which technically puts us in a year two for AMAO 3 as well. I tried to think of a chart to explain this easier, and I couldn't come up with it, so here we go. So the Title III plan for San Luis Coastal focuses on two objectives. The first is to provide high-quality professional development for our K-12 teachers, principals, and instructional aides on the new California English Language Development Standards, as well as the ELA-ELD framework, as well as research-based instructional strategies for working with our English learners. We believe that this is the best way to prepare our staff to meet the challenges of providing a rigorous curriculum for our English learners at the same time that they are learning a second language. The second focus of our plan is to increase English learner parent and guardian participation in the education of their children. Increase access, increase engagement. We all know that meaningful participation is critical for student success. We believe we can do a better job in providing this access and engagement in the school system for our parents. In your packet, we provided the Title III Improvement Plan needs assessment that led to the development of the improvement plan. We also included the 8 required goals of the plan. At this time, Don and I are here, our EL intervention TOSA, to answer any questions you might have. In looking forward, on March 31st, we have an EL presentation that Don will be spearheading that will be giving you more specifics about the professional development and our strategies for engaging our parents, plans for the 2014-15 Wait, is it already? 15-16 school year, excuse me. And with that, if you have any questions or...
Well, I have just clarification.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you are seeking tonight discussion and approval of the plan?
Yes.
You'd like us to,
that would be mine.
If possible, to approve this evening. Okay, first we'll see if anyone from the public wants to speak to this. Okay, anyone from the board? Questions, comments, a motion? Anything? It is.
I'll move approval of our Title III Year 2 Improvement Plan.
All right.
I'll second that.
Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you.
All right, carries 7-0. Thank you. Both of you, thanks. All right, I have a yes. I thought I'd see Mr. Robinette walk to the podium. 10.03, evolution of career technical education.
Yes, thank you. It's really fun to follow Mary Zerman, 6-year-olds.
with something dazzle like us, this. Mr. Robinette. Yeah. Do your best.
Oh my
you can
gosh.
Do it.
So let's see if this clicker is working okay. Very good. So tonight my interest is to give you part two of what is sort of a three-part presentation that hopefully is getting towards some of those board questions. We had board queries for future agenda items, and the particular queries that I heard were, you know, should we require A through G for graduation? Should we allow CTE classes as potential graduation requirements as the law now allows? How do we get more CTE classes college preparatory? And so my purpose tonight is to look at number two, which is at the last meeting, we talked about A through G, right? So just I wanted to lay that foundation. What is A through G, and where are students falling through the cracks in our own system? Today is a little bit about career technical education, what has traditionally been called vocational education. Because I can't help myself, because I'm an old history teacher, I want to give a little bit of a history of vocab, because I think it's very instructive on where we've come and the significant changes that have happened only in the last 10 or 20 years that has really changed what voc ed has been historically. I would argue that our entire education system is still based on two models. There are 18th and 19th century models that came probably from Germany, that our system is largely based on an intellectual model of the Enlightenment, which is, you know, man is the measure of all things, and that we have certain people who are more intelligent than others, and we need to foster that intelligentsia. And an economic model based on the Industrial Revolution, that we need to make sure we populate our society with people who are worker bees, who can take care of our economic needs. And these structures are still the way our schools are structured, I would argue, and they've made assumptions about social structures and ability. Think about our schools. They are factory models. We ring bells. We separate age groups as if that's the way to separate abilities. We separate subjects. We control the duty day and the instructional day. We even base it on an old agrarian calendar where summers are off so people can go home and work on the farm. And part of the result of this is that we've had a belief that there are two types of people in our society, that there are smart people that are academically oriented and should go on academic tracks, and that there are, I won't say non-smart, but more non-academic types that need to be on some sort of a vocational track. And vocational education, as we know it, is really based on that idea. The first Voc Ed Act in the United States was something called the Smith-Hughes Act in 1917, which largely focused on agricultural classes, although over the years it developed into many more types of vocational opportunities for students. It did something that we've seen up until today, created a different funding model for vocational education from the rest of public education. We've seen that in California with ROP boards or particular grants focused towards just vocational education. The Smith-Hughes Act actually set up, when it was first established, separate boards of education within school districts. So you might have a high school district would have a board of education for their academic students and a board of education for students who were getting funds from the Smith-Hughes Act, and they would make independent decisions about students. It was based on this 50-25-25 model, which is if you were on this vocational track, you would spend 50% of your time in shop, in truly shop types of classes. You would spend 25% of your time in those kinds of classes that just contributed to that subject area. So if you were an ag person, it might be studying science and fertilizer science or something like that. But it would be devoted strictly to that. And 25% of your time would be spent in traditional academics, English and math. The result of this is that obviously at a very early age, intellectual development became limited for certain students. If they were on this track, they weren't taking the academic classes that might enable them to advance, because at an early age they were pigeonholed into these tracks. And also, they were given certain skills that might disappear once those jobs disappear, because they were very job-specific skills. Now, I'm sounding like I'm being really disparaging about career technical education. This is just historical. But we've seen through the 20th century that this is really the way voc ed has been in the United States. It's been a two-track system. In the 20s, it was about training boys and girls for work. ROTC came into this whole being that we needed to develop a national defense strategy within our high schools that trained students specifically for military careers. In the 30s, voc ed was largely to battle growing unemployment. In the 40s, the beginning is for the war effort, and then to transition to this peace and manufacturing economy, which was what the United States was all about in the late 40s. By the 1950s, we started having these titles added to federal education acts. Those titles aren't the same anymore. We still have Title II and Title III and Title IV, but they don't mean the same things anymore. Title II was about nursing, because originally nursing was something you learned in high school. You didn't necessarily have to advance to college for that degree. In the 60s, Title VIII was a reaction to Sputnik and the Russians putting men and monkeys in space ahead of us, and the need for developing vocational tracks towards engineering. In the 70s and the 80s, we had the Carl Perkins Vocational Act, which is still alive and well, and you approve Perkins funds every year. But all through that time, even though we've had some name changes, because it went from vocational education to the really popular one was tech prep, I'd say about 20 years ago. And Ken Sanfilippo is the expert in all this, so he's checking my facts, I'm sure, and going to just give me heck after this is over. But the philosophy has been quite consistent. You know, what we need to have is some system to fit certain people into their probable destinies. That second thing was actually a quote by John Dewey, who was against the Smith-Hughes Act. He was one of the fathers of public education because he believed vocational education would create a class system in the very institution that should be the great equalizer and not create this system. So lest you think I believe voc ed or career technical education is a bad idea, in the 90s and beyond, we saw some major changes in this world. For one thing, it became very evident that students who were in this voc track, I'll call it a lower track, because I think that's really what it was, that there was huge socioeconomic disparity between those students and the students who were in the academic tracks. The colleges were not attracting students of color. They were not attracting students of low socioeconomic status. NCLB, one of the great things about NCLB, and there are things that aren't so great about NCLB, is that there were two words put into that legislation, all and none, or no. Part of it was all students are going to reach a certain level. Now, we know those levels are kind of ridiculous. We just heard about 100% of EL kids being proficient at a certain level. But the idea of NCLB was let's make sure all students graduate from high school with certain ability levels and that no child will be left behind, which actually changed what career technical education is all about. The Common Core, which is what we're under right now, has a really interesting statement. It is about career and college readiness, which I think is really significant. It's not about career or college readiness. The Common Core standards were developed with that and in there, and not the or. So we're not trying to prepare kids for one track or the other, necessarily. So the modern CTE philosophy is that we need to organize our curriculum so that students are developing career skills, not necessarily job-specific skills. We've heard over and over again that five-year-olds in our system right now are going to enter careers that do not exist yet. I believe that's true. I believe the way technology is advancing, that's probably true. And so we have to be careful not to develop too many job-specific types of programs, but to really develop career skill-based programs that are transferable into career and college settings. So what would that look like? It would look like more academic content being incorporated into our vocational courses. This is happening naturally in many situations. You look at auto mechanics right now. When I took auto in high school, I could open my Toyota pickup truck and look and see the ground beneath it, and it was pretty easy to figure out how to fix things on it. You can't open up a modern car, and I don't even know what's there. It's a box that I don't recognize. So in a very natural way, many of our vocational courses, our CTA courses, are becoming far more technical and far more academic just naturally. It also means that academic courses need to become more vocationally relevant. The classic question that students ask, especially in high school, is, why do I have to do this? Why do I have to study this? How important is this? And teachers really should have answers to that question, because if we don't have answers to that question, it's a really legitimate question if we can't answer it. And so by making our academic courses more vocationally relevant, we should develop answers. It also means that we need to start viewing our high school curriculum as being far more project and active oriented as opposed to passive. Knowledge is ubiquitous. It's very easy to get information. So what we do in our high school programs, whether they're academic or vocational or CTE, is really look at project-based learning, that learn-by-doing idea that Cal Poly is famous for. And the thing that is the hardest to realize, because it's very time and labor intensive and we have a lot in our plate, is to create those real world opportunities for students. Apprenticeships in the real world, school-based enterprises where students are developing goods or services that they can market from their school site, cooperative education, articulation agreements with the community colleges. That's what the future looks like for us. So what about the board's interest in all this? And we're not going to make decisions tonight, but the board has asked about graduation requirements with CTE. I think Mr. Buckman had a specific question about that. 3 years ago, AB 1330 was passed by the state legislature, which allowed governing boards like yourself to the option of adding CTE to the current visual and performing art or foreign language requirement. So right now in the state of California and in our school district, every high school senior has to graduate with at least 1 year of visual and performing arts or foreign language. Under AB 1330, beginning with the class of 2013, this board could decide if it wanted to that a student can graduate with CTE or VAPA or foreign language 1 year. Now, there are pros and cons to that. You know, a pro would definitely be, it's just more choice. I mean, that gives students more opportunities and flexibilities to choose classes. The downside to it, of course, is that's why I introduced A through G first last time. If the board has an interest in elevating A through G, as you might recall, all students have to take visual and performing arts to satisfy an A through G requirement, and all students have to take 2 years of foreign language to satisfy an A through G requirement. Students don't have to take CTE classes to satisfy an A through G requirement, even though they can, even though there are college preparatory classes. So part of AB 1330 is a warning that if the board decides to do that, you have to be really clear with parents that they understand that this class might satisfy a graduation requirement, but it might not satisfy a college requirement. And so that's part of the reason that some school districts are not adopting that and others are. The other board interest had to do with A through G. And what we know is that many CTE courses can and will satisfy the G requirement, which is that elective requirement, and potentially other requirements, but some never will. And so we have to also measure that as we talk about career technical education. So, for example, in our own curriculum, just so you know, ag mechanics, that would be a class that does not qualify for A through G. There might be a way to do it, but it might dilute the class to be something that wouldn't look like the ag mechanics that students want to take, as opposed to something like most of our ag science classes, which do satisfy a science requirement. You can learn to be a computer technician in our schools, but computer technician classes don't qualify for A through G. But programming does, and so if you want to do coding and programming, that satisfies an A through G requirement. If you're taking a home economics class, there are foods classes that don't satisfy A through G. However, fashion design in our own curriculum satisfies an art requirement. And auto mechanics is very difficult to satisfy A through G requirements, although there are ways to do it. There's more and more of that stuff happening. So let me just give you my opinion, because your opinions are going to matter later when we discuss what to do about this. So you don't have to agree with me. My opinion is that we need to become post-enlightenment and post-industrial in how we think about public education, for heaven's sakes. We're the slowest institution to change of all the bureaucracies. We are in a world where we know that students are coming to us being able to access information at their fingerprints, at their fingertips. And so we need to set up systems where we really are doing project-based learning and where those CTE and academic classes are really blending. And we are not we are way past the Industrial Revolution, and the greatness of our country is really going to be based on a knowledge economy, a reaction to the global economy, and really reinstituting what has made us great, which is Yankee ingenuity, inventiveness, entrepreneurship that we can develop in our high schools. Which means to me that we should really continue to embrace and nurture the CTE programs we have, whether or not they're college preparatory. But just not as a track for kids to go through. In other words, not as a way of getting through high school to avoid rigor or to just get through school on a second tier. Why in the world would we mess with our auto program at Slo High School that wins awards year after year, or our agricultural programs, our FFA things that actually develop those career skills that are really useful? So we should continue to nurture those programs, but I don't think we have to get too enamored with making everything college preparatory, because kids are in high school for all kinds of reasons, and academics, athletics, being part of those clubs, being part of those programs are all part of the high school experience. There's a new word coming out. It might change CTE, which is vocationalism. It's kind of going back to the old word, which is that this is really all about career and college readiness, and the skills are very similar. The things that business people are asking our students to be prepared for are the same things that colleges are asking. They want students who know how to collaborate together, who know how to solve problems, who can look and read technical writing, who can read nonfiction texts and make discernments out of them. Those are all common core standards aligned, and so hopefully what we are going to start seeing is a blend of career and college readiness. So that's the precursor of next time when we can actually get into what does the board want to do with the details. Okay, available for questions.
Okay, first we'll see if anyone in the audience would like to come up and talk about this. And Mark.
Thanks, Rick. That was I've never learned so much history in this short amount of time.
Uh-oh.
Having sat on the ROP board and having attended at least one statewide conference on this, and is Ken still here? Mm-hmm. And a conference up at Ken's place where I think he started out with, was it 80 students in ROP, Ken, and 800 by the time you left. One of the things that I came away with was that there are thousands of ROP, CTE, whatever we want to call them this year, classes that do meet the A to G requirement don't diminish the class that they're teaching and don't take away from the rigor of what's happening. I think personally, and just one of I'm a strong believer in the arts. There's STEM in most of the United States. We have STEAM here. I think there's an entryway for a lot of students that are not going to necessarily... it creates another entryway into the potential for going on or for doing well in their careers if we have that third option in the VAPA foreign language and CTE. And I'm trying to remember one of the things you said, and it's not coming to my mind, but it was that somehow it wasn't possible to get an A to G. It wasn't possible to take A to G a full year of something and fulfill that, and so they would be missing out on that as one of their options for fulfilling A to G's for requirements. And everything that I've read and learned about it is that's exactly the opposite, that districts will adopt classes and will come forward. In fact, I think at our last board meeting, at least one of the two classes we approved, if not both, were to take subject matter that was not A to G prior and to start turning it into A to G.
Absolutely. And I guess I want to make sure I clarify that point in talking about the AB 1330 is we know that we have a college entrance requirement for UCs and CSUs. I mean, obviously, there's other institutions of having to take 2 years of a foreign language mandatory and having to take 1 year of a visual performing arts. There is no college requirement to take CTE. And so CTE classes, many of them could meet some of those requirements. We have CTE classes that would meet the visual performing arts requirement. Interior design is a great example. It's taught within our home economics and careers department. That's an A through G art class that meets not only a CTE, it's not only a CTE class, but it meets the art standard. But those requirements for visual and performing arts and foreign language still stand, and it's just one of those things we have to keep in mind. If we were to say you can take this or this or this, we have to make sure we're clearly communicating. Because, and one of the things I mentioned last time, and our high school counselors I think would concur, certain students the last thing they fulfill is their art requirement. If they're not musically inclined, a lot of students just kind of go through school and they're not taking drama, they're not taking dance, they're not taking music, and they hit their senior year and go, I better sign up for ceramics because I have to get this thing done in order to get to college. And we just want to make sure those students don't take some high school graduation requirement thinking that will satisfy an A through G requirement. But there's plenty of good reasons to do it. And you're absolutely right. On the books right now, I think I mentioned last meeting, of the high school curriculum in the state of California, out of the 1,000 school districts, is about 40,000 CTE classes. About 10,000 of those are A through G approved, which is a significant number. One in four of all CTE classes that are offered in the state of California meet A through G requirements, usually in the G, usually in the elective, but sometimes in science, sometimes in mathematics, sometimes in art. So there are other areas that the requirements are being met. So we should continue to look at that, I think, it's very important.
I'm hoping we can go back and review the VAP of foreign language and CTE, ROP role in that location, because my understanding is that the CSU and UCs are accepting that, and that it is fulfilling part of the requirement to get into the
can
into
fulfill
the system.
The letter G, it can fulfill that, those CTE classes.
And we're talking about VAPA and foreign language.
If they're a class like interior design, not foreign language. I don't know if there's any CTE foreign language classes.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Let's take small diesel mechanics, and it's been geared up, and it is a G fulfillment, and the board has adopted a board policy that says now, one, you can fulfill the requirement for graduation through a CTE, the VAPA, or the foreign language track, and it's my understanding that's just not throwing away the G, it's actually enhancing the G and letting students choose to do that. And the model that we're establishing in the district, the STEAM model, can be, I think, greatly supported by offering that CTE at that location, because if what we're really doing is incorporating art not as, oh, and by the way, we have a choir, oh, by the way, we have a drama program, but there was one tonight that was just so right on target, one of the ones that got a grant, and I'm sorry, I can't remember it. It was, well, we have just combined whatever stage set design and the engineering to do stage sets as within the drama department. Those kinds of melding and really putting art changing STEM to STEAM will, I think, really blossom if we allow the CTE to fulfill some of that, to fulfill the G requirement, because they should be, I mean, VAPA and CTE should be right there anyway if we're going to be doing the STEAM model. So I'm hoping there's going to be a lot more discussion on this, and I'd really
Absolutely.
Like to explore AB 1330's ability for the board to fulfill that graduation requirement.
Catherine?
Thank you, Alan. Rick, as you bring this back to us and when you reflect on this, my hope would be that you might be able to give some thought to how we could actually blend the CTE and the A through G, and similar to Mark's comments. But my thought is more about, I'm afraid that it will remain a two-track system if we don't do that. And also, I see some really practical outcomes for that. I see students who are now taking the AP classes in the A through G who have no practical hands-on experience, mm-hmm. and it's all a cerebral experience, and they really don't learn any of these skills, and they don't get that integration of the both sides of their brains. And then on the other hand, I see some, you know, a lot of highly intelligent kids that, you know, are great at taking apart and putting back together computers, and that have the ability to be a Steve Wozniak if that's what they choose to be. But if they finish their high school education and they don't have the A through G requirements and can't go to college, that might hold them back. Or if they're great automotive mechanics but they don't have, you know, they want to go on later and become a business operator, you know, get a business degree. So my hope would be that we could look at how to have the both relevance of the CTE and the rigor of the classes in all of our classes. Acknowledging that not all the students are going to want to shoot that high necessarily to get into college right away, but maybe they would be, we'd have a combination of prep honors in both of those so we could meet a lot of needs at the same time. That's a tall order, but I know your brilliant mind will reflect on that and bring us something back with that.
Excellent.
Thanks.
If I may, I do have two questions, Rick. One, if you were able to fix the engine on your Toyota, then can you explain why the well didn't work?
It well works beautifully. The well is working beautifully, but I had to do a lot of interim assessments to get there.
So it's the modern Toyota that's not running.
Yeah.
Okay. And then secondly, I shared with Dr. Prater what I thought was a very interesting blog or editorial on what used to be tracking and what's going on now. And if I can find it, I'm wondering if my fellow board members might be interested in reading it, because it was a really interesting perspective.
Yeah,
on
we are in such a healthier
that, just
place
on that
than
question.
We used to be.
Just
so
on
I'm
that
glad.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to make a couple comments. First of all, I think that these high school opportunities, the more we can offer, the better, keeping in mind the constraints of the UC CSU systems. I think any opportunity we have to keep as many doors open to our students as possible, because if today they say they don't want to go to college, but in a couple of years they say they do, but are in a place that might make it difficult to have to go backwards a little bit. And I think that we owe it to our students who say that it's a huge responsibility of ours for students who feel pretty certain they are not going to go to college, that we need to graduate them with the very highest quality, best education they could possibly have if their 12th year of high school is, if they're not going any further. And I think that's a huge responsibility that we need to take very seriously. I think when we assume that all students are going to go on to college, in a perfect world, I think their college has a lot going for it in terms of just contributing to the knowledge base of anybody and making students a better, more prepared citizen of the world. But it's also an unrealistic expectation. But if we can get them through this bureaucratic system we've created with as many doors remaining open as possible, I see that as part of my personal mission sitting here on this board, and believe it to be shared by many. So I think that's something we need to keep in mind all the time as we pursue this process. So my two cents. Anything else? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. We'll look forward to part 3. math textbook adoption.
Thank you.
I have with me tonight Diana Jones, our pre-K through 6th grade math teacher on a special assignment, and we are here tonight to bring you a recommendation to adopt a 3-5 Common Core aligned math program. As you're aware, our 3rd through 5th grade teachers have participated in 3 years now of ongoing professional development to prepare for the shifts in pedagogy and rigor of the Common Core state standards in mathematics. For the past year and a half, we've also been searching for that best possible program to support our teachers in the classroom. Last August, we began a pilot of Bridges Second Edition, which is the Common Core aligned program, in 20-plus of our 3rd through 5th grade classrooms. We chose Bridges for a number of reasons. First of all, the variety, the use of visual models, its coordination with our already adopted K-2 program, and its alignment with best research practices. Earlier this year, we reconvened the 3-5 math adoption panel, the IMAP, and this was made up of 16 members, including 10 classroom teachers. The panel had representation from all of our elementary sites. The IMAP was facilitated a school site evaluation of the Bridges program. A rating scale was used by teachers and parents to provide feedback on the program. The IMAP then received the feedback, reviewed it, as well as the reviews from the 20 pilot teachers. On February 23rd, we had our meeting. They unanimously recommended the Bridges Second Edition program for adoption for our 3rd through 5th grade classrooms. And in addition, the team provided rationale for the recommendation, as well as input to Diana and myself on a professional development plan of how to bring it in smoothly. It's interesting to note, and you'll remember this from a year ago with the K-2 Bridges, that Bridges is not on the state-adopted list for instructional materials. It's thanks to the newer education code that was added in 2013 that we're now able to consider non-state-adopted materials. In order to do this, the materials must meet the required 6 criteria, and the adoption panel must have the majority of classroom teachers on it. The 6 criteria are described in detail on the board item that you received and include the math content, alignment with standards, the program organization, assessment, universal access, instructional planning, and teacher support. I'm confident that the Bridges Second Edition program will be a wonderful support for our 3rd through 5th grade teachers in providing a student-centered, rigorous Common Core aligned math program. The initial costs for the program include teacher guides, student workbooks, homework workbooks, and all of the needed manipulatives to successfully teach the program. The initial cost is $137,000, and then there will be annual costs for consumables. Diana Jones is here with me tonight, and she has really become our Bridges expert, and we're ready to answer any questions you might have regarding the program. Before I turn it over to you, I would like to thank the pilot teachers and the members of our 3rd through 5th grade IMAP committee for their participation. And this item is here for your discussion and possible adoption.
Okay, before asking the board if they have questions, we'll see if anyone in the audience wants to speak to this. Seeing none. Chris?
Sure. So I have 3 questions for you, Amy, and I think I sent them to you earlier today. I know I did, as a matter of fact.
That's why I brought Diana.
So the first question is, were there any concerns or weaknesses from the teachers about the program?
Would you like me to answer that? Thank you for asking that. I think that that's very important as we look at a new program for teachers to implement. And the area that teachers showed initial concern in was in technology, knowing that in grades 3 through 5, our students are going to be tested on a digital platform. So we are very lucky to have very innovative and brilliant teachers who started attacking that right away and have used their technology skills to integrate the testing and the activities that are provided in Bridges through Google Classrooms, iPad apps, and different ways in their classroom to be able to use the technology that's provided by Math Learning Center and other technology in the classroom for that. So while the tests are not adaptive, students are able to take tests on the computer as well as do daily activities and lessons.
I'm thinking back that I recall a concern a teacher shared with me who was doing a combo class, that it was difficult to, that they were having a difficult time doing bridges if they were saying doing a 4-5 combo.
Mm-hmm.
And has that issue been resolved?
That issue has been brought up many times, and where we end up almost every time is combo classes are a common core issue. They're not a curriculum issue. And it's definitely something that was brought up as part of our meeting of what is that professional development and additional support that combo teachers would need if implementing bridges.
Okay. And then I know math and requires now a lot of consumables.
Mm-hmm.
One of the concerns I have thinking about teacher workload is this a lot of stuff that, and I'm in support of this. I hear it's a great program, but I am curious about, are there a number of consumables that the teachers themselves have to create, or are the things that are part of the program inclusive of the consumables they're using so that they're not out, Xeroxing at 6 o'clock at night?
Right. That's a great question. And I think that's one of the benefits of bridges, is that a lot of the components are included. So each student, the consumables that are used every year are the student workbooks for Number Corner, which is one part of the program, the student workbooks for the problems and investigations component, which is another part, and the home connection. So all of those worksheet-y sort of things are already provided and don't need to be copied. Additionally, something that teachers have been so appreciative about is that all of the games are already prepped. They're on cardstock, they're in color, and they're laminated. So they're going to be used year after year. So that won't be a prep that teachers have to do. The first year of implementation, we saw this with our pilot teachers, and then again this year for K-2, there is some prep required for Number Corner, but it's things like posters, and many teachers are catching on around November, December, hey, if I just make these and laminate them and use them with a vis-a-vis marker, I can clean them off and use them again next year. Okay. So there is some prep for that initial year, but that hopefully we can be able to save that and reuse it.
Okay, and then the last question. I know that especially the group of teachers that this is targeting were really, for the last couple of years, struggling with trying to create their own curriculum, and I'm assuming this will do away with that and give them that help they need so they're not struggling to figure out how to teach math. Is that...
I can tell that you've been talking to teachers. These are all of the things that they bring up. It's awesome. Absolutely. I think that the benefit of this is that it's a comprehensive curriculum. So it has all the components of it. It has what does your number talk look like? What are the assessments, both formative and summative? What are the interventions that I can use, both extension and with students who need a little extra work with it? So teachers are still going to need to use their judgment, right? If anything, there's too many materials, so they have to decide what is appropriate for my students now. But in looking through it, and again, that's part of the PD that we're planning to provide, knowing how those materials are set up so that teachers can use their knowledge to make those decisions.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Carolyn. Thanks. From the discussion that I had with teachers, I pretty much follows what Chris has brought up and what you've explained, that some were piloting bridges, some were piloting the Live Binder program that was developed by our own teachers, and the interface with technology was mentioned to me as well, that bridges didn't lend itself to interface with technology. I just want to make sure that that's been resolved now, because that was really an expressed concern to me. And then also on the consumable end of it, I got the impression from the teachers that I talked to that Live Binder really required a lot more prep on their part than Bridges did. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think that anybody using that would agree with that. So the live binder is online. So teachers had to print out the master of anything that they were going to use and then make a class set of that. So if you think about classwork, homework, extra practice, all of that's provided in Bridges that they're not running off those copies versus the live binder where they are. To address that one. As far as the technology goes, I think that that's something that we're going to continue to learn and grow with. I know that we have teachers who are just eating up everything that's coming about technology and being really creative about how to integrate what is available in Bridges with the technology. So as an example, Math Learning Center is the nonprofit organization that published Bridges, and they have free apps that are available online so that they're available to use on the internet, so through a Chromebook or through an iPad. So for whatever devices are out there, there's free apps that students can use. So teachers are putting those into Google Classrooms so that students can use those in that way, or putting them out at centers so that students can use them in that way. There's also games that are linked by skill. So for first grade, if you're working on adding, here's a whole bunch of games that you can play about adding. So bringing those sort of things in.
Okay, thank you. I'm still unclear. This is a 3 through 6 we're talking about an adoption.
3-5.
So it's a 3-5 because Common Core Math goes to 5th grade. We adopted K-2 last year, mm-hmm. and then we piloted 3rd through 5th grade this year because it wasn't developed last year. So we couldn't pilot it all the way through. So now we're recommending to adopt 3-5.
So we'll have a full elementary adoption.
Yes.
Okay. Well, then if there... Oh, Mr. Questenberry.
Well, just an observation about something that Amy did that I just have to comment on, and then another thing. When Amy was talking, you were talking about the live binder, and the teachers had to do a lot of preparation, and it sounded like they might have had to copy things. I think Amy did this motion. I'm not sure people under the age of 35 know what this indicates. You know, the old Ditto machine. Yeah, mimeograph. Okay, Ditto mimeograph. Okay, yeah. Sorry, Amy, but I just couldn't resist. The other thing is, I did have a chance to see one of these lessons with the number talk, and I thought that was really interesting. I was taught by nuns, and God bless them. They were all actually very wonderful to me, concerning what kind of student I was. But to watch the students work through on the board the different approaches to solving the same problem, mm-hmm. all of them valid, and to see that, you know, that I know that there's a kid out there that really benefited from seeing the different ones,
yeah.
and that there's more than one way to solve it. So thank you very much for your presentation.
I would like to add to that if I can. I think one of the really amazing things about Number Corner is when we're talking about STEAM and STEM, it ties in science and math and engineering. Kids are building things and measuring things and looking at weight and mass. And I think that that's a really amazing component too, and that it does fit very closely with the Common Core goals of being able to honor all ways of doing things and make sense of them.
Anything else? If so we could waive a second reading if it is the board's pleasure and vote on the adoption this evening. Marilyn?
I'll move approval of the adoption of, what I'm calling it, the Math Learning Center Bridges in Mathematics, second edition, for grades 3-5.
I'll second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, you've been approved. All right.
Ellen, can I ask one real quick question?
Yes.
Did I miss one, or is this the first adoption we've done in about 8 years or 6? We did one last year. I missed that.
Okay. Look at all you prepared people up here. Item 10.05, CPM update and adoption recommendation.
Great. So tonight, Barb Solitis and I would like to update you on college preparatory mathematics and also ask for your recommendation of Algebra 1, Geometry, and Algebra 2 adoption of that program. So we're going to give you kind of a little background of the... What's it going?
Only Amy knows how to work the new clicker.
My new clicker. It's because I'm my IT director. It always happens that way. There we go. So we're going to start with a little teacher perspective of just the path and the changes that have occurred with Common Core and how CPM has influenced that in the perspective and just changes that teachers are seeing using this curriculum and while we've been piloting that.
What I'd like to point out with Common Core is, and what I see is the use of language that students have now. They may not think that they are understanding material better, but I am hearing them use mathematical language with each other, with me. I'm hearing explanations that they never would have used before. Before, it would be me as a teacher at the board taking occasional questions, lecturing, walking them through steps, and then having them go home and repeat that. Now it is somewhat of a discovery approach, which can be a little bit frustrating, but I hear students using the language. I hear students asking me questions that involve that language. And if you think of mathematics as a language, the only way you're going to learn it is to use it, and to hear it, to see it, and to use it to communicate to others. That's one of the big intents of Common Core, is that students will use mathematical language to communicate their thinking. And it's important to note that that thinking doesn't have to be correct. There has to be some debate about it, some discussion. I always tell my students to compare and contrast as necessary with their work. That's the biggest difference I see. Students, and these students are new to this program, so I think that they need some transition time, but I think their understanding of mathematics as a language, as a tool for problem solving, is going to greatly increase every year that they use it.
The main thing that I see as a big change in my classroom is that kids really are much more interacting with each other, help each other understand concepts, persevere with a problem, work through it until they try to figure it out on their own. We have teams, so if one team can't help each other, they're able to go and use other teams to get some help. But the perseverance, working together as teams, is the main change that I see.
Okay, and I am going to talk to you about CPM. CPM is College Preparatory Mathematics, and CPM was started back with Eisenhower funds back in 1989. It is a nonprofit California-based company. They were mainly in the state of California, and they are now throughout the United States as well as international. They're teaching CPM in Hong Kong right now. And some of the guiding principles of CPM is that students should be engaged in problem-based lessons structured around a core idea, and they are guided by knowledgeable teachers. Students should interact in groups to foster mathematical discourse, and practice with concepts and procedures should be spaced over time because mastery comes with time. And there's a vision statement that I love from CPM, and it says, CPM envisions a world where mathematics is viewed as intriguing and useful and is appreciated by all, where powerful mathematical thinking is an essential, universal, and desirable trait, and where people are empowered by mathematical problem solving and reasoning to solve the world's problems. I just thought that was a really beautiful statement from CPM. So we... right now have 20 teachers that are piloting CPM. We're piloting in Algebra, Geometry, and Algebra 2. and we are piloting at all of our secondary sites. So in the summer, our teachers did 4 days of training. CPM has a very big training program. They believe that teachers need to be fully trained in order to utilize their program effectively. And then we have had follow-up trainings throughout the school year. So we had 4 trainings in the summer that our teachers went through, and then we've done 3 follow-ups throughout the school year. And their training is provided by teachers who are teaching the courses, and their teachers have to have at least, their teacher trainers have at least 2 years teaching the courses, and then they're specially trained by CPM. So the power in that is that when these teachers are working with us, they have that practical, this is how it works in your classroom. We're able to see what the program is and how it's going to be best used with our students. And the teachers are going through what the lessons are going to be. We engage in the training by going through and being students ourselves to see that this is what our students are going to be doing. So it's a very big part of their program. They believe in a lot of professional development in order to utilize their program. So we did have the pilot teachers come together in January, and we provided pizza, so we had a big group that showed up. But we really wanted to talk about what are the pros and cons of CPM. So we looked at it from the perspective of the teachers. We also looked at it from the perspective of the students. And I did want to read to you some of the comments that the teachers did make. So teachers made comments such as students had more aha moments. Teaches students to persevere and try all problems. It develops life skills for students to think, write, express, explain, discuss, justify, interpret questions and problems, and it really answers the why in math. It utilizes the 8 mathematical practices effectively. It has cyclical reasoning, so spiraling, cumulative, and constant review. Students are forced to think deeply and critically. And a statement that I thought was very strong is they felt like it engaged both teachers and students alike. And students have deep mathematical conversations. Retention rate is higher for students. And that students take ownership of the learning and help teach one another and challenge one another's thoughts. And then certainly they did express some concerns. A big concern that the teachers expressed with the Algebra Geometry, Algebra 2 program is that it does not have Spanish versions of the student books. And I have been in contact with vice president, one of the VPs with CPM, saying that we are really concerned about that because it does have the translate feature through their ebook, but the teachers that were trying to translate for their level 1 and 2 students found it to be difficult because of formatting issues. CPM is now writing Spanish versions for Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2. So he said we are right now in the process of producing those. They will be available for next year. So that was something that we were very concerned about. CPM is now providing that. So we were happy to hear that. And then another concern that teachers expressed is that this program does require you to be very prepared for your classes. So you can't come in and open up to page 273 and just start teaching. You do have to go through all the teacher notes. It is a scripted program as far as what you should prepare, the materials you need for your students, the different activities you're going to be doing with your students. So it does require that upfront work. But we all feel that this is our first time through, and that next year it will go much smoother because we know what to expect. We are also coming together, the teachers are coming together to discuss what they felt was very good with the program and then maybe some things we can do to adjust it. But we needed to go through the program the first year. We also had to do a lot of teaching of content that our students didn't have because of the shift in the Common Core. So our Algebra 2 teachers had to teach 2 big areas that our kids now are learning in Algebra 1, but because our students were not in Common Core Algebra 1, they never had that content, like series and sequence and exponential functions. So our Algebra 2 teachers had to spend weeks teaching that. Next year we won't have to do that. So those were some of the pitfalls that we had with CPM, but it was also because this is our first year of implementing. And then we did have a survey. I did a Survey Monkey with the teachers. And so asked them various questions about CPM, and then I did ask them a question, and the question was, or it was a statement, I would recommend CPM for adoption. So I had 18 of the 20 pilot teachers respond to the survey. One did disagree. We had two that were neutral. There were eight that agreed, and there were seven that strongly agreed. So of the 18 responders, one did disagree. And the teacher that disagreed said she felt that we should wait because of thinking that there is curriculum in development now, that maybe something better will be coming. So that was her concern, that maybe we should wait and not do it at this time. And so we will be doing pilots now. We had an in-service with our 7th and 8th grade teachers today. And so we are going to be piloting CPM now for 6, 7, and 8. We met with all the 6th grade teachers. They all gave a thumbs up. We took them through a couple of CPM lessons so they could see what that's like. We asked CPM if we could host the training here at San Luis Coastal. So we are going to be having the training the first week of summer. And so that will be for 6th, 7th, and 8th grade teachers. And that's going to be at Laguna Middle School. And then it's going to be the same process with the pilot teachers, that they would also have the training throughout the school year. Whoops. Okay.
So just the last piece to mention is that, we feel like, talking about analyzing the program, that every program has strengths and weaknesses. There's no silver bullet of a curriculum. So one of the pieces that we've looked at is we feel like CPM will be a super strong foundation for us. But we also want to hold on to some of the other things that we believe in strongly, like with STEAM. So when we look at SVMIs, you've heard throughout the years of the connection that we have with the Silicon Valley Math Institute. And they have some really strong components that we're not going to just throw away, that we're going to hold on to some of those strong components and add it into what CPM brings to the table. Technology, kind of like Diana was mentioning, that we're looking at how can we use technology as kind of that science to help teachers to differentiate and to meet individual needs and to use technology and devices to add to CPM so that we can help meet individual needs better. And then that science integration is the other piece. We're looking at how can we continue to make a STEAM model, and how can you have project-based learning and have those powerful things that we believe in within the foundation of CPM. So we're kind of calling that CPM Plus is kind of the concept, and teachers are grabbing onto that, and there was a lot of excitement around that today. So we're looking forward to building even beyond CPM to make it great for us. So just in conclusion, that's kind of the update on CPM, and our recommendation is to approve that for Algebra 1 Geometry and Algebra 2, and then we look forward to starting a pilot in the middle school, junior highs as well.
Okay, anyone from the public wanting to talk about this? Right. Mark, then Jim.
Thank you. So I was all on board, and I was listening, it's like, good, and then that teacher's one point about there's something coming, and I guess my opinion is there's always something coming. So if I kept waiting, I'd still be driving my 1985 Chevy van. But my other question is since we're going more and more online, are the publishers offering free updates? So when they, or is it going to be like in the old days when every time you wanted a new operating system, it was $300?
Yeah, so the ebook has an 8-year you give kind of an ear subscription, and so the updates and those kind of things are built in and come with it. So it is a great option. When we were looking at options, we were kind of hoping, actually, that there were some more ebook options out there. It just seems that publishers haven't completely got on board with that concept. So it's something that we were even giving those that didn't seem as hefty a little more of an extra chance, because we were kind of hoping that it was heading that direction. But this is definitely the strongest program that we've come across.
Jim.
My question has to do with professional development. This is an adoption for all those classes, right? Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2. And I noticed that the pilot teachers had their professional development over the summer. Is that correct? And then that will continue for all the teachers that are going to be teaching those classes in 15-16. Is that correct?
The model is that you go through their summer training is for new teachers in the program, and then the follow-up training is throughout the year to support the teachers that are new to the program. So we did the 4 days in service for Algebra, Geometry, Algebra 2, and then we've had the follow-up in services throughout the school year. And it's sequenced where I think our first for the school year was in October. So the training gets you, it's all the curriculum you're going to be teaching for the first months of school, maybe month and a half, and then they do the follow-ups to get you ready for those next chapters that are going to be coming up. But that's for anybody brand new in the program. So the training this year, this summer, is for our pilot teachers in the middle school program. Because our Algebra, Geometry, Algebra 2 teachers have already gone through the CPM training, yes.
Great. Thank you.
And I would say I'm happy to hear that our teachers will remain involved with the Silicon Valley Math Institute. I think that it just provides more tools for the toolbox, rather than completely devoting ourselves to one path, to continue to look at other options and have other opportunities to learn. All right. Anyone like to make a motion on this CPM update and adoption?
Yes, I'd like to make that motion, please.
Okay. Second?
I'll second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, item 10.06, ballot completion for CSBA delegate. Dr. Pritt.
I'll take that, yes. The CSBA delegate assembly for Region 9 represents all districts in San Luis Obispo County. Two delegates are elected with staggering terms. In March 2014, Mr. Buckman was reelected to his post. The other representative seat is currently up for election. Each member district may submit one vote. The incumbent is Vicki Meager from CMR, who has submitted her name for consideration. Board member Field Gibson of Paso Robles has also thrown in his
hat in the ring.
That's it. Hat in the ring. Yes. So it's up to you.
Jim.
So this is a time for us to speak on behalf of one or the other. If we have an option, I would support Vicki Meager. I think she has the experience as a classroom teacher and as a board member to be a very valuable representative.
I guess the correct pronunciation, I botched it, it's mayor.
I would support Mr. Quisenberry's comments and add that I've had the opportunity to work with her for a year as she's been on the CSBA Board of Delegates. I've also had the opportunity to work with Field on the ROP, and Vicki is just a quick learner. One of the things I really love about her is she's so collaborative, so willing to listen to other people. There's a lot of board members in that room, and we all think we know more than everyone else. It's kind of humbling when you're up there. And Vicki just has really excelled at what we need as a representative from this area.
All right, any further discussion? So we vote. So I don't think I don't know that this requires a motion. If it does, okay. I just thought maybe we voted.
So if it's
we move to vote, I guess. What are we doing?
Yeah, as a board, you get to choose one. So you need to make a motion to pick one person over the other, and
okay.
We'll submit that ballot for you.
Jim.
I move that we support Vicki Mager from Lucia Mar as the delegate to the CSBA Assembly, Subregion 9C.
And I'd like to second that motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Oh, look, we have an audience of one. We expect to hear from you at every opportunity.
I'm getting up to talk about the CIU agreement.
Okay. Only if it's pulled.
I know, but if they have a question, I'm here.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to see how quickly I can read these. It is time for the action consent agenda. 11.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 11.02, approval of SEIU agreement. You may leave. 11.03, acceptance of donations. 11.04, approval of furniture and equipment requests.
Please pull.
11.05, approval of purchase orders. 11.06, approval of warrants and payroll. So a motion for...
You got it.
Marilyn, yeah, you just say it.
I'll move approval of items 11.01, 11.02, 03, 05, and 06.
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Mark, 11.04.
Yes, just quickly on 11.04, within this list, there's a Canon 2251 copier reconditioned, and I just need to ask, my understanding is within the district we have a fairly comprehensive copier contract, and I'm is this part of that contract or is this outside the contract?
You know what, I'm not sure if it's outside. I'm not sure if it's outside the contract or not. I mean, I know that there are times when schools will purchase using their funds an extra copy and then it gets put in and they actually have to pay the fees for those copiers that they out of their school sites. So, but our copier service does cover all of the copiers in the district. So it would cover this.
It would cover this.
Yes.
Okay. I move approval of 11.04 on the consent agenda item.
I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Any advance agenda items? Okay, reports by board members.
No, you take the first one.
Well, just a couple of things. Thank you. Last Tuesday, I think it was, Mr. Millar and I went over to the Elks Pool and got to see the submersibles that were created by the students from Pacific Beach. It was great. It was so... Yeah, it was so much fun, and they were just having a great time and working as a team. I think everybody saw the article in the Tribune.
Yes,
it was really fun to see them come over and show off our students. So that was great. And then just a couple things CSBA wise. I went to a legislative committee meeting where we're starting to talk about what the legislative agenda of the organization will be and what things we support and what things we don't support. It's really interesting, and that'll be coming. We'll be having a couple more meetings on that, so I'll let you know what specifically we're talking about. And then this coming Tuesday is CSBA Ledge Action Day, and there are three things that it's a no-cost day other than just getting up there. It's not like the old days when you had to pay. The first thing is, of course, the repeal of the reserve cap. The second thing is getting more equal funds for home-to-school transportation because a lot of districts are really suffering over that. And then the third is to try to get a facilities bond available, and, of course, that would help us tremendously.
Mark.
Thanks for all your work, Chris. Are you ever home?
Yes.
Good. I just have two short items. Did Dr. Seuss Day, I guess, early, and I had an absolutely great experience out at Los Ranchos School with the fifth graders. I downloaded or bought two reader plays, and the students, we had actually a good time, and it went fairly quickly. And then we had some time left, so we added some funk to One Fish, Two Fish. There was some clapping and stomping, evidently maybe too loud for Marley, but Mrs. Schmidt, but we did it. And then I'd also like to thank all the parents and teachers who have taken the time in the past month or so to email myself and fellow board members, and who also felt comfortable enough to talk to me at the grocery store, usually while I had just put ice cream in my shopping cart. But that was okay.
Okay, Catherine.
Just quickly, I was able to visit Baywood, and I told Mrs. Donnelly that I'd like to see one of our model tech classrooms. And this was so much fun because there were two things I saw that I've never seen before. One was that the children had their pads, and they could actually read their own story into the pad, and then it would read it back to them, and they could learn heard their own voices reading their stories, and they were making up the stories, and it was just this totally interactive, wonderful experience they were enjoying. And then in the next classroom, the teacher was on the floor with the students. They were arranging, doing their manipulatives in math, and then he stopped and he got out his phone and he took a picture. And then they went on and did something else, and I went up to him and said, "So what are you going to do with this picture?" And he said, "I'm going to put it on Twitter today so the parents can follow what we're doing in the classroom." And we have so far two followers, but eventually their goal is to have the parents kind of check in all day long. It's like, oh, so that's what my second grader is doing today, and now I can talk about it to him at dinner. So very fun.
Great. Thank you.
Just want to thank... was it Mandy or was it Kim, the Friday notes and the mention, or who submitted the, yeah, okay, on the resource fair? I thought that was great, and I had a great time there. It was fun. I got to connect with some of my former students. A lot of them are, some are working for the district, and some are working in different other agencies that were there. And it was, as mentioned, well attended, and it was, I think, very informational for the community and for the parents especially.
Thank you.
Informative.
All right. We will adjourn. Our next meeting will be on March 17th at Del Mar. Jim?
Is that our roast?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes